everybody. Welcome to PodQuest. We have a special episode this week with Matt Hawkins of Top Cow. He is the president, COO, and he makes all kinds of comics for them. Matt, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I love podcasts, so it's always good to get on these things.
Yeah, I listen to a ton of them myself. Like, it's always cool to hear different perspectives of people, like in comics or games or television or what have you.
Yeah, and I actually had the hubris to think that I could make one, so I recorded like 5 episodes of one I wanted to do, and then I actually went back and listened to myself to try to edit it, and I hated how I sounded so much that I quit.
That's the thing you can't do. Like, after our first episode, I stopped listening to it. You just kind of, you take notes if there's something that you really need to cut out, and then otherwise you just... You run the basic stuff. Like, you make sure that, like, all the levels look good. You listen to just little snippets of it to make sure it sounds okay. And then, like, truncate silence and stuff like that. Things that can just sort of polish it up. This way you don't have to listen to your own voice.
I should have done that. And mine was, I wanted to do... Like, I have 3 basic obsessions in life. I love science. I love, like, pop culture and entertainment. And I love religion. Those things I can just endlessly discuss and talk to people about. So I wanted to record this podcast about all those things, and because there's so many, you know, comic podcasts that I didn't want to do just another comic podcast. I actually wanted to do something that sort of dealt with like these various interests of mine, and like I said, I recorded several episodes and then shit canned it once my voice and realized how stupid I sound. You know,
I mean, as somebody who listens to just an absurd amount of podcasts every week, that sounds like something that would actually be cool to listen to if you ever decided to go back to it. Especially, like, you're in a position where you could pull in people from comics and, like, have those discussions with them and then potentially draw in, like, the comic book crowd to it.
Yeah, not just comics. I mean, almost all the guys I went to college with and in my fraternity and the various places I've been are all pretty high-up scientists in the military-industrial complex.
Oh, wow.
One of my best friends is like the head of one of the departments at Raytheon, and I have lunch with him about once a month. And so I've got connections. I got connections in those fields. And then I was a Christian the first 27 years of my life, and I've been an atheist the next 20 years of my life. So it's been an interesting ride. Life.
I mean, I follow you on Facebook, and I see, like, every once in a while you'll have sort of lengthy posts about religion, and it's never bashing anything. It's always very sort of topical most of the time, but also open-minded. Like, you're asking questions, people that maybe are in those different religions, but it, like, from a very, very educated place.
Well, I believed in that stuff for so long, and I think every new atheist, especially people that fancy themselves smart, go through what I call the asshole phase of kind of this militant atheism, where they want to go out and tell everyone they're stupid for believing these fictional stories and all this sort of stuff. And I did that. I honestly, you know what? I was 27, 28 when I kind of lost my faith and I did that for a while. And then I realized, you know, my parents are very smart people. My mom has like a PhD. My dad is like, you know, graduate level guy, and they're Christians. And all I'm doing is offending the people I care about the most. So And I have really interesting conversations, you know, when I was, it's crazy, but it was the research I was doing for the first comic I wrote called Lady Pendragon that actually ultimately made me question my faith in Christianity. I'm obsessive when it comes to research, and you know, in 1995, 96, when I was doing the research for Lady Pendragon, it was kind of pre-internet, you know, there wasn't like you didn't have the ability to go online and just lose half a day searching and reading shit online, you know?
Yeah.
Back then, you had to read books, and then you have to look at the footnotes, and then you have to track down those books, and then you have to read those books. And, you know, I spent 2 years doing the research for Lady Pendragon, which would take me about 2 weeks today.
Yeah, you know, it's nuts to think about it that way.
Yeah, it was 2 years, dude. I mean, I was on phone calling, you know, and I actually went to England and drove around and took photographs for reference. And, you know, now there's just so much photography online that I'm writing a story today that featured Cal State Los Angeles. It's a college out here and a girl that goes to this college. And I literally wanted to know what the financial aid department and looked like. And I found all of it online, photos of it, you know, all over the place. So it's amazing the photo reference you can use to make stuff more realistic.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, I was talking to another comic book writer back in September, and a book that he had published, his artist was from Italy, I believe, had never been to New York City, but drew like an almost perfect representation of Penn, like that Amtrak waiting area of Penn Station.
Right.
And because like I live right outside of Philadelphia, but I travel to New York for work regularly enough that I'm flipping through this book and I get to that scene. I'm just like, wow, that is Penn Station. Like I've been there 100 times. And when I was talking to him, he's like, oh no, he's never actually been there. Like he looked up pictures online and got everything he needed.
Well, see, that's an artist. I need to work with whoever that artist is, because every artist I work with is lazy, and I don't mean that. But I actually include like a shit ton of photos. I mean, if you look at the scripts I send to artists, they're sometimes 40, 50 pages long, but half of them are either photo reference or art reference or something that I'm just including. I used to just send links, and then I found that, especially when you go to other countries and stuff, some people have a hard time getting links of certain things. So I eventually just started cutting and pasting photos. And so I send these PDFs of my plots to the artists, and most of the artists I work with really appreciate it, actually, because it saves them a lot of time. And, you know, as the writer, I can write 4 books in a month, and most artists can't do more than 1 a book a month. So yeah. I don't mind doing the extra step. You know?
Yeah, and I guess when you're picking out like real world places, like colleges or train stations, you know, you want to have them look the way that you're describing them in the writing, so this way it makes sense if a person's going from like point A to point B.
Yeah, and I think it also depends on the story. Like the story I was working on today is this original graphic novel I'm doing with Yishun Lee, follows Baldwin, kind of the Sunstone world. It's sort of a sex positive story. A romantic slice of life book that I'm writing with my wife. And it's about a girl who goes to Cal State Los Angeles and gets into kind of a modern day Pretty Woman is the easiest way I can suggest what it is.
So pretty different from a lot of your other stuff.
Yeah. You know, I got to tell you, man, when Sunstone, you know, I did Sunstone as kind of a favor to Stjepan Sajic. And he's like, I'm doing, cause you know, he was working on Witchblade with Ron Mars. And then he worked on Aphrodite 9 with me. And then he started doing this online story called Sunstone, and he kept getting all these page views, and it was one of these things where I was looking at his DeviantArt, and I'm like, wow, man, you get a lot of views on this thing. But I didn't really understand 7-8 years ago how webcomics work. I think we all have a better understanding of how they work now, and
yeah.
Can translate to physical sales. Two, three, 4 years ago, I don't remember exactly when it is. Time sort of. Is nebulous to me anymore, but he asked if I'd be interested in putting them out, and he said he has a lot of people that were asking for them, and so I solicited the first couple volumes, and Jesus Christ, man, these things sold insane numbers. I mean, they were outselling every other book we did, which was a complete shock, and I would take these books. I do a lot of conventions. In fact, I think people are shocked by this, but I do 18 or 19 conventions a year. I'm doing almost a third of my sales hand-to-hand, person-to-person,
yeah,
a year.
I was at New York this past year, like, what was that, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that?
Yeah.
And a couple times I was circling through the artist alley, and I wanted to stop to actually see if you'd be interested in coming on the show. But you always had, like, a group of people, and they looked like they were either, like, asking you about your books or purchasing books, and I'm not the type of guy who I want to, like, butt in there to, like, be like, hey, do you want to come record a podcast with me when you could be, like, pitching your books to somebody who's never read them before?
Well, and that's, I have kind of a strategy, and it really works for me, and I share it with anyone, so I'll share it with you, and you can share it with people that listen to your podcast. I give away books constantly. On Fridays at conventions, almost all day, I will give out free comic books to anyone that will want one. And I always tell people, I said, I'll give you a free comic to read, but on one condition. You got to read it. If you're here all 3 days, I want you to swing back by Saturday or Sunday and tell me what you think. And it's usually like a first issue. Like, we do these image first books, like things we have multiple volumes of. And I will give those out to people. And, you know, and I have 5 volumes of Think Tank to sell. We've got 6 volumes of Postal to sell. And, you know, I got 4 volumes of Aphrodite 9 to sell. So people swing back around and they said, oh, I read this. And then they want to talk to me about it. And, you know, if people don't like it, they don't come back to tell you they don't like it. I've actually never had that happen. So I'm kind of never say never, you know. But
Now, and they'll. I know you mentioned that you're going to be at Tucson this weekend. So this weekend will be when that happens.
that's fine. I mean, if it happens, I'm gonna laugh, and I'm gonna laugh, take a picture with them, and post on about it. Because no, the people, you know, I mean, how many comics do I give out? I don't know, maybe 1,000, you know. Wow. And then how many people come back and buy stuff? I don't know, 50, maybe 100, you know. So it's like a you know, less than maybe a percent or two. It's a very low turn. But the thing is it helps. And yeah, I see people all the time online that add me on Twitter, and I'll chat with people like, oh, how, or people tell me they like my books. I'm like, oh, how'd you discover them? And it's almost never. And this is the sad part of, you know, non kind of big two publishing, and I include Image and Top Cow in that category, obviously. But I very, very rarely will find someone that'll say, oh, you know, I found your book at a comic store, or, you know, that almost never happens. It's almost always, hey, I saw you at X convention and you gave me a book and I wanted to try it. Or my friend, you know, reads your books and likes it. And then sometimes I'll press a little further and said, well, how did your friend find the books? Sometimes, you know, who knows? Some of these people I've known for years. You know, I've been in the comic business since 93, so it's been a while.
Yeah.
It's a hustle game. I always tell people all the time, it's a real hustle game. You really got to get out there and talk to people. Because, you know, you got to think about, most comic fans, how do they find comics they want to read? They walk into a comic shop, they look around, they pick up a few things, and they walk out. The vast majority of people don't have pull lists. The vast majority of people don't go to CBR or to Newsarama or Bleeding Cool. Honestly, and no offense to you, I mean, I'm happy to do all these podcasts because I'll always reach someone. You know, I mean, there's always somebody you'll reach that hasn't heard of you before and they like what you have to say. But it's very, very rare that people will say, oh, you know, I went in the shop and found your stuff and tried it out. I mean, it has happened. It does happen, but it's actually exceedingly rare.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, and there's so, and part of that is, I think there's like, someone told me at Diamond at New York that there's 2,500 books coming out a month, whether that's reprints, trades, or new books. So there's 2,500 different, you know, 32-page comics, trade paperbacks, or whatever it is, coming out on a monthly basis. And even the bigger stores, you know, there's only 5 or 10 stores nationwide in the United States that carry 100% of everything made.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that's not a big number. And most of these are the heavy-duty mail order companies, you know. Like, they'll order a couple copies just so they can say they do that.
Yeah.
But, no, so my thing is, in order to get someone to try something, you either need to woo them, which is meeting them in person and talking to them and telling them the story, or you give them something to try, or you sell them something very cheap, which is Humble Bundles and digital free. Like, we have, I think there's over 50 books on topcow.com that are free PDFs, and I openly tell people they can repost them wherever the fuck they want.
I think you guys offer a lot of free stuff on Comixology, too.
Yeah.
Like Image as a whole, not just Top Cow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there are definitely, you know, I mean, and we do see some people that we definitely get downloads. I mean, every time I'll tweet out, you know, on the Top Cow feed, I think we have like 100,000 followers or something like that. I haven't looked, but maybe it's half that. I don't recall. But, you know, we'll see 10, 15 people that'll click the link, you know. You don't really know whether or not they actually read it, but we track the links and we're able to see who opens the link. So every time we do some sort of a push in social media, we'll see some sort of traction. But I've not seen, and it's impossible to track how you sell stuff and how it works really from digital sales to other sales. I've noticed that when I give somebody a free comic at a convention, about half of them will ask me to sign it. And I'll do that. And those are the people that usually want to talk or I hear from again or they're curious. I think as indie comic authors or whatever we want to call ourselves, we have to get people to try our work. You know, there are fans of Spider-Man that will just buy something because it's Spider-Man. But, you know, if you're writing something original or you're writing something that has a very small following, they're not inclined to try that at all.
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's why I was actually going to make that exact comment that, you know, if somebody walks into a comic book store, they see Spider-Man, they see Batman, they kind of know what they're getting. They see, you know, just random person on a book or, you know, what have you. It's like, well, I don't know what this is. I've never heard of it. Why am I going to spend my $3, $4 on something I've never heard of? And then they just go buy their next Batman book.
And the problem is most books, you know, I hate to say this because I'm going to sound like a dick. Most comics made aren't very good. you know, and that again is it's a subjective aesthetic opinion. But I can't tell you how often I read a comic and I'm like, what the fuck was that? You know,
and you probably
have
to read tons of them, or not have to, but you probably do read tons of them.
I probably read fewer than you think. I mean, I read all, I get all the Image books for free. I get the, I'm on the DC and Marvel comp list, so I get a shit ton of comics. I think the thing is, when you don't pay for something, you don't feel any pressure to read it right away.
Yeah.
So I have thousands of books just stacked up that I've never even flipped through. I mean, I'll flip through, like, artists. For me, is because I've been in this industry for so long, like, a lot of these people I know, so I'll see, oh, there's Humberto Ramos' new book. I'll check it out. I'll put it in the separate pile. You know what I mean? Or, hey, I just met Matt Rosenberg at Boston. He was a cool dude. Let me try one of his books. I've never read something by him. I mean, so for me in the industry, it's more about personal connection and do I like this person and do I want to give their work a shot, you know. But there's so many books that come out that are so forgettable. And I think this is my biggest beef with like Big Two Comics is there's so many really forgettable books, you know. And I ask people this all the time. Let me ask you, Chris, how many comics do you think you've read in your lifetime?
I couldn't even tell you. Thousands.
Thousands. Okay. How many of those do you think you actually recall and remember?
In the hundreds, easily.
Okay. And how many more would be enhanced if you saw the cover? Maybe a factor of 10?
If that, to be, like, because it's one of those, I read a lot of digital. So,
right.
Like, I buy the physical just because I'm 31. So, like, I'm still young, but I'm getting to that point now where, you know, space is becoming an issue. Like, I only have so much space in my house, so thousands of comic books are sort of eating up on that space.
Right.
So, like, I'm slowly sort of whittling back on what physical I have, and I'm trying to go more digital. But, yeah, so, like, I don't even know if a cover would necessarily jump out at me. Covers are usually what so when I go into the store, if a cover grabs me, I might pick up the book, flip through it, see if the actual interior art, like, hangs on to it.
So it's not bait and switch like so many companies, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, so you've learned by doing, and the fact that you do this podcast, you know, you're more into it than most people. Most people are far more casual about this. And so I talk to people all the time. I'm like, part of the reason why I write the books the way I do is I do a lot of back matter. I add like not just a comic, but there's a lot. It's a full experience. And like if you actually read every word I write in every one of my books, including all the book and the stuff in the back, not just like a letters page, like I'll write enhanced material about what the story was about. I'll write what the research was. I'll say, hey, if you like this concept, like, I don't know, dark matter or whatever it is, or quantum entanglement, here's a bunch of videos you can go watch to try to understand it. Here's the basic concept of what it is.
I forget what you call them, science classes?
Yeah.
I think, right?
Yeah, science class for the science-y books. That's Think Tank and Wildfire and The Clock and probably, you know, and then I do Sunday School for the Tithe. But they're all kind of the same thing. It's just basically... you know, I'm doing sex ed for the Swing and Sugar books I'm doing. And I know that's where we started on this, and I'll swing back around to explain where I was going with the subject of that all. But the idea for me is when you read a comic, the typical comic, you can read it in 3 to 5 minutes, and honestly, you never think about it again. And that, to me, is kind of sad. And if you think about that, you're spending $3 to $5 on something that you can read in 5 minutes and never think about ever again. Do you think that's a good value for your entertainment dollar?
Not at all.
It's not. And yet that's the bulk of what our industry is based on. And it kind of frightens me. And it's why I've tried so hard to work directly. And I have a strong readership through Amazon, the Comixology, direct through our own sales and stuff like that. And I've continued to push, you know, and try to do better on my material through the comic shops. But at this point, probably... And this isn't Top Cow necessarily. This is me personally. Top Cow's statistics are a little different. But I would guess, and this is a fairly accurate guess, that less than 50% of the books that I write that are sold are actually sold into comic stores. I sell a lot more trades, like books like Think Tank. You know, if you take a book like Think Tank, I sold, I think, 6,000 copies average of the 32-page books of those, which isn't a great number, not a horrible number in today's market. But I've sold well over 30,000 copies of the first volume of the trade, and it's in its third printing, you know? And so you sell these things over time, and that's the nice thing also about being indie and pushing your own stuff is you never know when someone's going to discover you. And if they discover you, they like you, and they like your material, you have a nice little backlist of stuff they can find and they can read.
Yeah, and you actually, like, from how you've been describing it and just what I've seen, like, the few times I've seen you at shows, you actually, like... You push your books the way that, like, somebody like me buys them. Like, if I'm walking through a convention and the person's just kind of like staring at the floor, sitting at their booth, and like has just absolutely no like drive to like talk to you about their book to show that it's something that they care about, like,
right.
Why do I want to spend the money to buy the book? But at,
yeah, every time hard, I, by yeah, the way.
Every time
it's
I see you, you're always talking to people, and even I think it was New York Comic Con last year, 2016. I purchased, I want to say it was the first two volumes of Postal.
Cool.
After talking with Isaac, like it was like a late Sunday, like I was getting ready to leave. He was just kind of hanging out the table, and I started chatting with him, and he was talking about the book. I'm like, you know, I've seen this book a bunch of times. I don't want to sound like a dick, but like I'm on a bunch of like the comp list too. Like I get all the review books for like Image and DC and stuff.
Right.
Like you said, you know, when you get the books, you don't often have time to like sit down and like read through all of them.
Yeah.
So I tend to like pick stuff up in trade, especially when like a creator's there to like tell me like this is why I enjoy making this book.
Yeah. No, and Isaac's good at that, and some of the guys that work with me on stuff, I've kind of hand trained them on how I do it, and their first few at conventions experiences are usually with me. So they kind of they learn very quickly. It's why Zach Kaplan, I think, is doing as well as he is because I sat him down very early on and said, look, this is how I do this and it works. If you're willing to do the work, you can build a following. And he did Eclipse and he hustled his ass, did a lot of cons, did a lot of store signings. He actually does a lot more comic book store signings than I do because I've found those to be less effective than conventions. I like doing them and I love comic stores. I'm not bagging on comic stores at all. I mean, we wouldn't be in business at all if it wasn't for comic stores and the direct market, and Diamond has basically built us and they continue to be the backbone of the business. But, you know, I mean, here's the biggest problem we have in the direct market is comic stores don't know how to order a lot of books from independent creators because they're afraid to eat them. And I 100% get that. And I've talked to so many retailers who tell me, look, I'd rather sell out of 5 books than get 10 and be stuck with 2. So and I get that. And I guess, you know, the math works for them. And but the problem is if they order, let's say, 2 copies of my new book, and let's say even this person follows me on Facebook and they know in the back of their mind that my new book's going to be in the store today. Well, what happens if they get there 10 minutes after some guy bought the last copy? They don't even know it actually came out. They probably don't even think about it, and they forgot about it. So do they know, you know, I mean, people don't – we're very much an impulse culture now, which is why I think you know, that digital is grown the way it has. And I think that's, you know, so I, you know, we're continuing to push in every channel. You know, I mean, I would love to do better in comic book stores, but we're pushing very heavily in Amazon, conventions, and, you know, digital. And I'm trying to push in every possible channel. So
stores seem difficult too. Just, I mean, I only, where I'm at, we actually have a lot of shops. Like, I am lucky enough to live in an area where, you know, I can name like 6 shops right off the top of my head that are within like a 10-minute drive of me.
Right.
But like the one that I go to primarily, like I've been going there for years. Like I know the guy that works the shop, and he tells me all the time that, you know, the owner is very reluctant to give him the amount of books that he requests, even though he's the one working the shop day to day. Like he knows what will sell, but it's still one of those, even on bigger books, like, you know, like new Spider-Man comes out and it's, you know, he knows that he's going to have, you know, 20 issues that are pulled, and then he wants another 15 for like walk-ins because he knows he'll sell through them. The owner might give him 7 additional copies on top of the pull list, and then he's out of it on Wednesday, and then somebody that can't make it until Saturday, like they just can't get the book.
Yeah, and the thing is, a lot of times most people don't even know the book ever came out.
Yeah.
And see, that's the frustrating thing for me, because when I first started doing conventions in heavily, for me, I wrote comics in the 90s, and then I stopped in 99, and I did not write any comics until 2009.
So I took
10 complete years off of writing comics. I was still the president of Top Cow and doing a variety of other things and editing and writing outlines and creating, but I wasn't physically writing comics, you know. Long story short, I got married in 99. I got had 2 kids, got divorced in 2008, have full custody of my kids. And for me, I wrote a book called Think Tank in 2009 that came out in 2010 as honestly something to distract me. You know, it was meant to kind of distract me from the personal drama I was going through. And it sort of worked. I had a really good time. And not only that, the book sold really well. And then I did very quick math and I realized, hey, when I write a comic, I'm not paying the writer, so my break even is lower. I can actually pay an artist more money and work with better artists.
And that actually makes a lot of sense. And you have those contacts too, since you've been in the industry so long. Like, you know artists, you know the guys that you want to work with that you can work.
Yeah, and these guys just want to get, you know, I mean, artists want to get paid. You know, they don't want to work for free. And I, like I said, I know these guys and I'm happy to work with them. And so I get to work with really good artists and it's exciting for me. I really like it. I like the work I do. And it's really weird. I've kind of shifted into a different phase of my career. And now, you know, I've got 4 or 5 books coming out a month and have been coming out for almost 7 years. And I've built quite a backlist of material. And it is interesting. Most people don't. I think because I've aged reasonably well. You know, I think part of that's just because I stayed thin. I work out and I didn't lose my hair. People don't know. You know, so I get people all the time that guess I'm in my late 30s is sort of what's guessed. And, you know, I'm almost 50 now. So it's a nice, you know, I have 2 teenage children that are almost adults. Well, they're adults, but you know what I mean. I mean, one of my kids is about to go to college. So it really is interesting. And I don't want to see the frustrating thing for me. And I got to figure this out. It's one of the reasons why we're trying to do more stuff with Kickstarter, more stuff with digital, and do more stuff with Amazon and sort of these mass market book chains, because getting older, I can't do this volume at conventions forever. I can tell you, I started slowing down in my late 40s and I felt it, you know, and doing 18 to 20 conventions a year in my late 40s when I've got I'm remarried. I've got a new wife. I had been married for a few years. You know, I've got these 2 teenage children. I'm trying to get sent off to college. It's hard, man. It's hard. And I go to these conventions, like, you know, I was just at New York Comic Con, and I've been to New York Comic Con every year. And there are people that come to New York Comic Con now and they know that I'll be there and they'll catch up on my stuff. And I'm fine with that ultimately because they're buying and reading my books. But I always ask them, I said, well, what would you do if I didn't come to the show anymore? And they kind of look at me blankly, you know, and I'm like, would you actually seek it out? Would you try to find it at, you know, a comic shop or at Amazon? And most of them kind of, you know, they say, yeah, of course. But, I, you know, who knows? You know, I mean, so.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that with a lot of stuff, too. Like, there are creators that, like, I might not know on, like, a personal level, but I know their work and I know, you know, they're either going to be at New York or Baltimore or, like, one of the East Coast conventions that I can regularly get to. That right. I wait till then, because then I can pick up the books right from them. And yeah, like, if they weren't there, then, like, I might forget that, like, their books came out. And maybe it's like 2 years, I'm like, oh shit, they've had like 3 new volumes come out. Like, I should try and track those down. And maybe by that point they're not even in print anymore.
So. Yeah, you know, it certainly is. The good thing for that is New York and San Diego, I will always go to. You know, I mean, those are 2 shows I will always do. We have really good position at Artist Alley floor for New York. And we have the big booth that we do at San Diego Comic-Con that if I ever stopped doing it, I would lose the space. So I'll always do those 2 shows, pending health issues or something grave. So
I have never been able to get out to San Diego myself. When you say you have a big booth, is it like you have it at New York where it's just your booth, or is it a Top Cow booth?
No, it's a Top Cow booth. We have a 20 by 20 island that's right next to the Image booth, which is between – Image has like a 100 by 100 island. Top Cow is a 20 by 20 island, and on the other side of Top Cow is Marvel, and they have like 100 by 100. So we're kind of in between Marvel and Image on the main aisle, and we've been there since '82. So we've got a great spot.
Do you know what size Image has at New York? Because that's one that I'm familiar with.
It's smaller than the San Diego one. I think the one at New York is 60 by 30 or 40 or
okay, 20. So it's significantly smaller.
Yeah. Well, the Image one for there's actually 2 parts to the one. You know, they have that giant thing at New York.
Yeah.
The wall that Boom sort of ripped off the idea of it. Image had that 10 years before Boom did.
I think IDW does it now too.
Oh, really?
Maybe I'm just like thinking of Boom, because all the big publishers are kind of all right in that area. So some of them kind of blend together a little bit.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's 2 sections of the Image booth at San Diego. So there's an effect. You know how there's one of those? There's actually 2 of those at San Diego.
Oh, wow.
So, and there's a space in between it where people queue up for signatures and stuff.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, someday I'll definitely get out to San Diego, but
it's a daunting show. I mean, I often question why fans go to that show. I talk to people I know, and I'm like, you basically go stand in a line to get a wristband to go stand in another line. And people do it, you know. And, you know, I mean, it's different for if you're just going to hang out with comic people or get some autographs or get a sketch. I mean, that's a little different, a little easier. But the vast majority of people going to Comic-Con or San Diego are there for Hall H or these other things. Yeah. And it's just I refuse to stand in a line for 7 hours to get a wristband to then go stand in another line for 5 hours. You know, fuck that.
No, I'm right there with you.
I honestly just don't get it. I mean, I'm glad that people do it. The one thing I like about New York over San Diego is in New York with the Artist Alley, and the reason why I don't set up the big booth is because, honestly, of San Diego. Because if San Diego, 9 out of 10 of the people that walk by our booth have zero interest in comics whatsoever. And then the 1 out of 10 people that walk by our booth, you know, maybe 1 or 2 out of that those 10 have any interest in our comics. So it's just it's very hard to usually, especially with the strategy I do where I give out free comics, you know, because if I give out 1,000 free comics at San Diego, they'd be gone in 2 hours, and I maybe have reached, you know, 1% of the people I actually want to reach.
Now, at New York, do you ever get up to the show floor, or do you just kind of hang out at your table most of the time?
I'll go up and take meetings at the Image booth. I'll take meetings at the Diamond booth. But for the most part, I don't like to walk up there because it's so crowded.
Yeah, well, so that's what I was going to say. Actually, like this past year particularly, I was there Friday and Sunday. And Friday I was just by myself. Sunday I had my wife with me. And I think total I was maybe on the show floor for a half an hour because it was so crowded you could not walk through it. And it was just one of those, like, this isn't fun. I can't see anything. There's just people everywhere constantly stopping to take pictures and stuff. Like, I spent more time just, like, kind of wandering around Artist Alley, which was also very crowded because you guys had less space this year, but still easier to walk around, see stuff. There were panels going on that didn't involve waiting in line all day, so.
Right.
But yeah, like, that show floor, like, it's insane. Like, it's almost not fun to be up there.
I think in order to, you know, I mean, with Image proper, there's so many properties that have, you know, there's a few of them probably involved in some sort of film and TV multimedia, especially with Walking Dead.
Yeah.
You know, that it makes sense that, you know, casual people will have interest. But, you know, I mean, I like Artist Alley because I know that the people down there actually read comics. There's no reason to go down there if you don't. I mean, you might get a couple looky-loos, but for the most part, the people that walk through there are comic readers. So when I hand somebody a free comic, say, hey, would you like a free comic? Would you like to try it? I know at least there's a shot that they'll become a fan and start reading my books. And see, like I said, what I've sort of realized is if I can convert someone to say try my stuff and then they read it and they like it, I will usually be able to sell that person a lot of other material. And because I have a pretty significant backlist, and every convention I go to, I come out of and there's a couple hundred new Twitter followers, you know, there's a couple hundred new Facebook followers, you know, and so I can sort of track that every time I hit a show. Like I said, New York and San Diego, I always do. But I also, like, I'm doing Tucson this weekend. I did that show 3 years ago, so this is the first time I've done that show in 3 years. The smaller shows, I tend to bounce around because there's so many of them now. I mean, it literally, I've talked to my wife about this and said, you know what might be kind of fun is to rent, like, an RV and just drive for 1 year and hit every fucking show.
I don't even know if you could because there are some weekends where there's, like, 2 or 3 a weekend.
Yeah, but you could hit a lot more, you know, and just this thing, because I think as a writer, I could write in an RV and write from the road. I probably won't do this, but it was one of those things where I know artists, you know, I know artists that have done this where they, I don't know if he still does it, but there's a guy, Shelby Robertson, I know, who was between sort of residences, and he was just traveling to hotels at conventions, and he would go set up and sell prints and sell sketches and headshots and it might not be him. I there was an artist I know that I've talked to that does this, but and he just, you know, that's what he's doing. He's like, no, he's leading a nomadic lifestyle.
So do you think if you didn't have the like the other responsibilities with Top Cal that you'd be more inclined to go do something like that? Assuming that your wife would be down for it too.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean the problem I have is I'm still, like I said, I'm still doing the Top Cal stuff, I'm filming TV stuff, the finance, the accounting, and all this sort of stuff. But it's just, you know, I don't know. I think it'd be fun to do for 3 to 6 months. I think I would burn out on that very quickly. Because the thing is, I do a convention and I'm so fucking tired for a day or two after that I don't want to do anything but lay there.
Yeah,
you know?
I can understand. I mean, for you, like, you actually have to be, like, on your game to, like, interact with people and not be, like, not be an asshole to anybody, because that's gonna just turn out poorly for you. Like, for me, like, I'm just there walking around, and, like, by Monday, it's like, man, I need just a day off of work just to kind of, like, recover from, like, looking at things.
Yeah, it's daunting. I mean, I think people don't realize how much energy it requires to stand and talk to people. And one of the things I do is I stand, you know, I mean, I don't know if you saw, there are some times I sit down for whatever reason, but I usually will stand. And the reason is because people are more likely to come over and chat with you if you're standing up. It's just something I've learned over the years.
Yeah.
And so, but standing and chatting with people all day long is really fucking tiring, you know, and I'm usually the first 2 or 3 hours, I'm usually fine, but I'll try to go get some lunch, or try to do something that to stretch my legs, or go get some energy to where it'll keep me going. Because otherwise, you know, if I'm there and I'm dead on my feet, I'm actually not helping anyone. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's probably worse, you know. So I usually try to bring a person or two with me that they can watch the booth while I go do something for an hour or so and kind of recuperate.
New York's good about, like, kind of grouping people together. I don't know if you guys actually request that sort of thing, but I know, like, this year and last year, like, you were right next to Isaac, so, like, you guys worked on books together, and I think there were a few other people, like, right around your area that, like, you all had, like, collaborated on stuff, so.
Yeah, that's definitely by design. I mean, we had requested that. I mean, there was a couple other people with Top Cow, Zach Kaplan and Ryan Katie, who I would have preferred to have near us, but they had requested to get in late and weren't able to get near us. So otherwise, yeah, ideally for me, everyone I work with would be in a single row.
Which, you know, I know DC did that in the back this year, and there were a few other companies that looked like they paid for, like, some artists to be there, that they all had, like, the same colored, like, backdrops and everything.
Right.
But I know this year in particular, it seemed like they, I guess because there was less space for everybody, they didn't do as well as sort of placing the big names where they weren't going to block tables.
Right. No, it was crowded as fuck. It was hard for me sometimes just to go take a piss, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember getting down there I think it was on Friday when I got down there, like, around, like, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I looked, I'm just like, holy God, what? How are there this many people crammed down here right now? Like, you couldn't actually get off the escalator because everyone was still trying to get into the room just off of that escalator.
Yeah. No, it was definitely nutty. And before I forget and we sign off, I want to circle back around to that Sedgwick point while I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, what we were talking, what started this sort of diatribe was about the idea of Sedgwick, you know, and the Sunstone, and the reason why I'm writing Swing and Sugar was because of conventions, and because I would go to these conventions and I would sell books, and the people who would read Sunstone were not the same people that would read, like, the other books I would write. And in many cases, the people that would buy and read Sunstone were middle-aged women, and those were not a significant portion of the readers I previously had. And these women would then tell me, hey, I really love this Sunstone book. What else do you have in this sort of genre? Is there something you have that's similar to this? And then I'd look at my table at Aphrodite 9 and all the other books I have, and I'm like, you know, I really don't. You know, this is all sci-fi stuff, and it's very different. And because the last thing I want to do on something I know they're going to hate, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why Swing and Sugar exist, and Bloodstain, is because we were trying to create content that would appeal to the people that were reading Sunstone. And Sunstone readers are almost all digital on Amazon. I mean, there is some direct market, but it's, I would say, 80% Amazon and digital.
Wow.
And these people would come up to shows and buy stuff from us, and now we have other books to sell them, and we're able to cross market. I'm a firm believer of doing titles in, like, groups of three. It's why Postal Think Tank and Tithe are kind of one little sort of subsect. You know, there was Aphrodite 9 and Cyberforce, and can't remember what the third ones we had in that loop. But you know, I like Witchblade, Darkness, Angelus. You know, always these things.
Yeah, like small little universe.
Yeah, like, because asking someone to spend $10 a month on something is reasonable, you know, if they're regular 32-page readers and not trade readers.
Yeah.
And if you are a trade reader, then you're really reading, what, probably one trade a month. So again, it's probably $10-$15 a month. And so that was kind of where the idea of the different titles came from. But so that's why I was writing these sort of slice of life romantic books to circle around to what we started all this with, was because I was trying to fill a market. You know, I mean, we had fans that were coming up and spending money that wanted to spend more money and get more content that they would like, and no one was giving it to them. So we created more.
Now, was that something like, because a lot of what you do is that sort of, you know, like you said, like science, religion, stuff that like you are passionate about. Was it weird to try and, you know, write stories in sort of just a totally different genre?
It was incredibly hard. And I have to tell you, I struggled with it because, you know, if you, I don't know if you've read Aphrodite 9, but if you break Aphrodite 9 down, it's essentially dragons fighting spaceships, you know?
Yeah, and, actually, I really like that book, so.
And I mean, but you know how easy it is to make dragons fighting spaceships cool? It's very easy.
It's just kind of cool when you say it, so.
Yeah, so, I mean, but when you're talking about a couple that's having relationship problems and want to get experimental with their sex lives, how do you make that interesting? You know, I mean, because it's not porn, you know, I mean, we're not trying to do porn because there's so much free porn out there. We're never going to compete, yeah. Which is why it always kind of blows my mind when people trip out on like, you know, nude covers and shit like that. I'm like, really? Come on. You know, there's 10 billion free hours of porn online.
And exactly. It's funny, though, because like books like that, look at Sex Criminals, like that. People love that book, and it's not really pornographic or anything like that. It's just, it's kind of like you said, it's a couple with an interesting sex life.
Well, I think that because it becomes about drama, and what I learned how to write slice of life romance, honestly, from the Sedgwicks. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do Swing with Linda, his wife, I'd worked with her on Wildfire, which is another science-y book that I did. But
actually, real quick, just so I don't forget this, is there ever going to be a follow-up to Wildfire?
Yeah, I have already written the second volume. I just Linda was going to do it originally, and then she did Bloodstain, and she did Tales of Honor, and then she did another Bloodstain, and now she's doing Swing. And I don't think she's ever going to do it, so I'm just going to have to find another artist.
That's a shame, because that book with her artwork, like literally, like one of the things I was going to ask you at New York was if that book was ever happening, because I've been waiting for that for what, like 3 years now.
Oh, it's probably been longer than that. I mean, I love that book. Yeah. It might, I don't know. I'd have to go back and look, but I think it came out in 2012, 13. And I left it wide open for a sequel. I mean,
yeah,
you
exactly.
Saw a grasshopper at the end. So obviously it's in mix now, you know? So, but, I have that in my list of books that I want to do.
Well, that's good to know.
It's just sometimes hard. It's hard because I have new ideas all the time. There's company books like Cyberforce and Witchblade and these other things that come up that need, you know, attention and we know they're going to sell, and we're trying to service these characters. So there's just only, and then these books pop up like Swing and Sugar, and it is really hard to write. It's not only hard to write slice of life stuff, it's also very hard to write full graphic novels, because I'm used to doing serialized stuff. And when you do serialized stuff, you're able to get feedback from people, and you can tweak things as you're going along.
Right.
When you write a full graphic novel, you can't do that.
I never thought about it like that. Yeah, I guess like even if it's just on like a month-to-month basis, like people don't like the way a character's written, you can start tweaking it in future issues.
Yeah, and you'll see people talk about it online, and their thoughts or questions or maybe things that you hadn't considered as a writer, and you can address those things, and then it seems like you had planned it from the start when you hadn't. And so, you know, I you use that as a crutch a little bit, which is why I think serialized comics will always be around in some format, whether it's just straight web comics to then graphic novels or whatever it is, because I think a lot of writers are just used to that kind of format.
Yeah.
But, yeah, writing slice of life stuff is difficult because, you know, if you have a couple that's in a restaurant and they get into a fight, you know, how do you make that compelling and interesting, and how do you make that work? See, I'm used to kind of, like Aphrodite 9 is an example. I wrote a text page introduction kind of like you saw in the Star Wars movies, where it basically gives you a shit ton of world building and boom, you're into the story. Now, you don't need that for a book like Swing, but, you know, when I wrote the first draft of Swing, I sent it to, and it was the first 20 pages, the first chapter. I sent it to the Sedgwicks. They sent it back to me with a bunch of notes. And I'm like, okay, I need to learn how to do this. I did a second draft, sent it back to them. And then Sedgwick called me on Skype, basically said, you know, you're not getting it. Why don't you go watch the first 10 minutes of Up, watch it like five times, then do a new draft. And I'm like, are you serious? And he's like, yes. And I'd seen Up before, but I'd kind of forgotten about it. So I went back and watched the first 10 minutes of Up, and it's that. Do you know the movie?
Oh yeah, I mean that is probably one of the like at least to me one of the most sort of the sort of heartwarming and depressing bits of cinema I can think of.
It's powerful.
Yeah, like the and it's a cartoon.
Yeah, and it's not even really what the story's about. You know what I mean? It's all set up, but yeah. It's so powerful. That I got it, and I went and I wrote, and I sent them a new draft, and then the draft was 36 pages for the first chapter, which is fine because you do an OGN. And then Linda broke it down and sent me a 56-page layouts, and I looked at it, and I'm like, so she turned what I originally wrote as a 20-page story and then rewrote as a 36-page, not story, but chapter, into a 56-page chapter. So we broke it into two chapters. So now what I originally was intending as a quick first chapter is now the first two long chapters of the book. We'll do probably some 90, 95 pages. It'll be 128-page printed length. Both Swing and Sugar we're doing for $10, like an introductory price point. So it's we're trying, again, the whole goal is to try to build a readership, because with Swing, I want to do 5 volumes. With Sugar, I want to do 5 volumes, kind of like Sedgwick did on Sunstone.
Yeah.
And I've looked at sort of the sales patterns and how it works. And, you know, you build someone as a fan of something, they want to read more of it.
Now, so to try and tie this into actually the reason why you came on, which we haven't gotten to yet, are you going to push these books on Kickstarter? Or are you just going to go sort of direct to like Amazon, Diamond, that sort of thing?
Direct to Diamond and Amazon and digital and all that for these. We've not done – I just did – the Kickstarter for Stairway is up now. It's been running. I was shocked. It funded on the second day, so I feel no pressure anymore on it, which is kind of – because, you know, I don't know about you, but I get annoyed when people – you know, suddenly launch their Kickstarters, and these are even people I know or like, and then their feeds for the next 30 days are nonstop, you know, their Kickstarter. And I completely understand that, but at the same time, it's kind of annoying. It makes me not want to read their feed, even after I've pledged it, you know what I mean? So I sort of wanted to not have to do that. And when we did Golgotha, which was last year, I'm sorry, it was earlier this year.
Was it really this year?
Yeah, I do one or two of these a year. I mean, that's kind of this is our fourth one. We did Cyberforce, and then we did the September Morning one. We did Golgotha, and now we've done Stairway. And Golgotha was the first one that I did that was based more on something I was doing and had come up with. And I wanted to experiment, and because everyone told me, I heard from the direct market channel, from Diamond and various people, that by doing a Kickstarter – we would not do as well in the regular channels. And that's actually what I was expecting. What happened was the exact opposite. We sold more trades through the direct market, the comics channels, and Amazon and the other stores and the bookstores than we would have otherwise. And I compare that directly with other books that I've written in the same format and genre and everything, and stuff that's even come out recently where I'm looking at. And so there is a tangible marketing effect of a successful crowdfunding campaign. But for me, I'm very honest with people. If you look at what I write in the videos or what I say or you know these kind of things, I'm very clear that these books are done. They're going to come out regardless. You're not pledging this to help make a dream come true. I'm looking at this as an additive distribution methodology, and that's what it is. And if you want to get a Kickstarter exclusive variant cover on a graphic novel and maybe some stickers, some pens, and some buttons, and some mini lithos, you know, or you want to have a chance to talk to me about your story or whatever. I mean, you know, these are things that we can offer through like a Kickstarter that you really can't do through these other channels. So you get to experiment and play with it. But, you know, it's like we talked about earlier. If you don't know what it is and you never heard of it, you're never going to try it. But for a book like Golgotha, you know, we promoted the Kickstarter. It was successful. People knew the Kickstarter was successful. And then the book came out into the regular channels and it sold better. I think people had heard about it. You know, it's one of where it's an awareness thing. So with Stairway, I tried something a little bit smarter, I think. I mean, I did it where the digital book was $10, the printed trade was $15. You know, if you wanted to buy it in the United States, the postage was $8. So it's going to cost $23. So the book in the comic shops, you know, it's hard to compete with Amazon and their shipping rates, you know, because if you buy the book from Amazon, it's probably going to be $11 and you might get free shipping. So, you know, if you're super value saver, you know, wait till Amazon comes. But if you want a variant, and see, the thing I offered with the Kickstarter is I'm willing to sign everybody's comics. Everybody, every one of these books I will sign.
Which is free. For people that can't get to conventions or can't get to the conventions that you're even at.
Yeah, so you can get, if you just want to spend the $23, you can get the book signed by me. You get some 25th anniversary Top Cow stickers, I think, or buttons or whatever the fuck it is, and you get it in the mail, and you're part of the campaign. And you know,
you offered a lot of actually really unique opportunities for the stuff. Like I'm actually looking at the Kickstarter page for it right now, and the fact that like. You sold $10,000 rewards to basically help people get a short story published.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan. I do the Top Cow Talent Hunt. I can't say it's annual because I more like to do it every other year because honestly, it's kind of a pain in the ass to do and takes forever.
I entered it actually. I think in 2013.
Oh, okay.
So it was the year that it was the artifacts were like the basis.
Very cool. So you know that I think. And I don't know what story you did or what you pitched, but you know what we discovered in the talent hunt with those is we got so many people that pitched the same story. It was really kind of surreal.
Oh wow!
We got like oh my god, what was it like? There was one year we did one of these things where like half the people pitched the same story almost. I mean, enough elements of it that if any of those people won, then there'd be enough other people that would cry foul. That so we started looking for things that were a little more offbeat and different.
Yeah.
You know, that were kind of unique in format. And what I always explain to people that, you know, I do the writers. Mark Sylvester does the artists. So the artist is very simple. I mean, we, you know, Ryan and a couple other people will sort of filter through the art, send the top 10 or 15, 20% to Mark, then he'll pick the winners. You know, when it comes to the writers, we do kind of the same thing. I have several people that read these. They'll filter me what they think are the top 10, 15, 20%, and then I will read those and pick the winners. But when I'm doing that, I kind of look for stuff that the mistakes that people make in pitching stuff like that is they pitch these open-ended long story arcs, you know, and that's this is a one-shot, so you got to write a contained one-shot story. People often try to do too much with it, you know. I think when you're doing a one-shot storyline, you really only have enough time really for one big emotional landing, you know, and you try to do much more than that or include too many different characters to be cute. It becomes too convoluted and too complex. So I honestly looked for very clean, clear, simple stories, and that's how we picked the winners.
Yeah, I think – was it this – most recent one that you were actually offering feedback on every submission?
Yeah, we did that. The last two we did that.
And, okay.
I'm not actually the one that does that or it wouldn't be offered. Ryan Cady, who's been working with me for a number of years, he does that and just did that. And I mean, it's not like a super comprehensive feedback. I tell people you'll get one paragraph of feedback.
But you know, for like an aspiring writer, that one paragraph could make all the difference.
And it's something where they don't get it because you know an artist can come up to me at a convention and if they're halfway decent, I'll spend a little bit of time with them and talk to them. But you know, I can't read people's stuff. You know, it's just very hard. People hand me stuff. I've had people hand me stuff on a Friday and say, "Hey, I'm giving this to you on a Friday. Can you read it? And can we talk about it on a Sunday?" And I'm like, "No, you know, I'm sorry, but I really can't. You know, I've got jam packed schedule. I got two panels tomorrow."
No,
I'm hanging out with people at night. I don't have time to read your thing.
When you say people hand you stuff, are they handing you like a finished book or are they handing you like their script or their pitch for a book?
Both. I mean, I prefer the comics. When people hand me a finished comic, like even if it's a Kinko's printed out job, I mean, I kind of like that because it shows a little bit of initiative and moxie and I'll actually read it because there's a chance I might like it.
Yeah, and I guess if they already have an artist, it's already a finished product. Like if it's good, it's always something that like you could pursue.
Yeah. The problem with handing someone a script, you know, is goddamn, that's like fucking work, you know?
Yeah.
And people do this to me all the time where they'll send me a script and ask me for feedback and then they'll follow up with me on it. And I always tell people, I said, look, I'm not going to give you detailed feedback and I may not even ever get to it to read it. You know, I go to so many cons and see so many of these people. They give me their stuff. I'll download it onto my iPad because every once in a while I'll be stuck somewhere at a train station or an airport and you know, and then I'll have like 100 of these on my iPad and I'll burn through a bunch of them and then I'll do that. But that's honestly kind of rare, you know? So I mean, some of these people, you know, I've had stuff on my iPad that they've sent me, and it's been there for 6 months to a year. I always tell people, you know, that follow up with me, I said, you know, follow up with me in 3 months, follow up with me in a month, follow up with me in 6 months. And I always tell them to use the same thread, because what always works with me is good old-fashioned guilt. You know, if I tell someone to read this in the next 2 months and then I don't do it, and then they follow up with me and I see that I said that I would read it in the next 2 months and I haven't done it, guess what gets read immediately, you know?
Yeah, it's so funny. I have seen you say that almost exact spiel, like, on Facebook, like, more than once. Like, I guess, so, I mean, you're definitely not just saying that. Like, that is something I've seen you say a couple of times.
Well, and people don't know what to expect. It's why I always tell people, you know, ask how to follow up with someone, you know? Here's the thing that I try to convey to people is, if you're writing a script or you're trying to submit something or you're trying to do a pitch, less is more. You really want to keep it very simple, very succinct. I mean, even a 1 or 2 page pitch is better than a 30 page script, because if you're a newbie writer, there's a really strong chance that I'm going to be able to find something I don't like in your script. And
I've heard a lot of like editors, particularly, say at like panels and stuff that, you know, they're not looking for a script to love; they're looking for a reason to hate it. Is that kind of how you look at that stuff? Like, not that you want to hate somebody's work, but like, you're looking for the problem, not necessarily looking for a reason to make it.
You're looking for, you know, this is shitty to say, but it's true, because I've been in this business a long time and I know all the editors. We're all looking for a reason to stop reading.
Which makes, I mean, honestly, that makes sense. I don't know how many pitches like end up in your inbox on like a monthly basis, but I'm sure it's enough where, you know, you don't have the time to realistically read all of them and respond to them and give them, like, read through every single one of them. Like, you need to find a point to cut off if you're reading it, if it's not worth finishing.
Yeah, and I always tell people the best pitch is, if people come up to me and say, hey, can I pitch my book to you? I said, do it in 30 seconds. And a lot of them will look at me like, what?
Elevator pitch.
Yeah, give me the quick pitch. And if they can't do it, because, oh my God, I've had to cut people off. And I've said, give it to me in 30 seconds. And then 6 minutes later, they're still telling me and showing me. And I'm already kind of tuned out. And they get so offended. But I don't know what to do about that. Because a lot of times when I'm at these shows, I'm there trying to sell books to people to buy and read my books.
Yeah.
So if I'm there talking to some guy for half an hour about his pitch, that's half an hour of people walking by that I don't get the chance to talk to.
Yeah, you're not there as, like, editor for Top Cal. You're there as writer.
Yeah, but people don't want to make that distinction. You know, everyone is me, 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 and no one wants feedback, by the way, man. They really don't. I mean, people want validation and they want a job.
Yeah,
you know,
they want the feedback to be, this is great, when can you, like, get me the finished copy?
Which rarely happens, because, and I try to explain this to people, I'm like, how many, you know, there are 300-350 full-time comic writers in the industry, that this is the living we make professionally. I think there's 900 people in the NBA. There's like 1,300 people in the NFL. You know, do people realistically think they're going to play in the NBA? You know, I mean, I'm not saying that comparing like that level of that, but there's just not a lot of job opportunity. And, you know, if you look at like the NFL, the average career is what, 4 or 5 years? You know, you're still competing with Mark Waid, Kurt Busiek, and Peter David. These guys have been writing comics for 30, 40 years.
Yeah, and they're names you recognize.
Yeah. You know, and I've been doing this for 24 years, now, you know, and I'm still doing it.
Now, if somebody gives you a pitch, are they giving you, like, I guess not even a pitch, but, so I was always under the impression that, like, Image as a whole, like, if you didn't have the full book, like, if you didn't have your art and your story and everything, it wasn't really an option, because you guys aren't going to take a book and then find somebody, an artist, to work with them, right?
Top Cow does. I mean, I've done that before. I've done that with different projects, and because we don't offer the sort of the pure creator-owned deal that Image does, because we don't need to, because that's what Image does. So people come to us with their ideas that they want us to find them an artist, to pay the artist, and want us to pay them to write the book. And we have done that in the past, but it's usually established people. It's Mark Miller. We did Wanted for Mark Miller. We're not doing, you know, some new or unknown.
Yeah. If I pitched you a book right now, you're not gonna be like, yeah, you know what, Chris, totally, like, get me that pitch and we'll find you an artist. Like, why would you?
It's very slim, I'd say, and here's the reason why: you might have a slightly better chance than most, is because I factor marketing reach into my decision making. And, you know, I look at, you've got a podcast, you have a, you've got a voice that reaches a certain number of people that you could possibly actually sell. For me, it's a business metric where I'm looking at, will I sell 5,000 copies of this book and break even? You know, because if I'm able to do that, there's a chance I'll do it.
Is that about the break even for a comic? Is about 5,000 copies
for us?
I mean, that's a huge number. So
I think that's lower than most because we don't have overhead. I mean, you know, you can go to some company offices like Boom or places, and you'll see 40 employees, you know, running around, and we don't have that. I mean, we did in the 90s, but I've slimmed the company down quite a bit, and we're kind of a lean and mean operation, which allows me sort of this versatility, you know.
Is that how you can kind of pull off, like, the talent hunts and, like, the anthology stuff that you're offering through the Kickstarter because you kind of have that little bit more flexibility with, you know, well, I can pay an artist to do this book because you just pledged this amount of money, like...
Yeah. Well, I know that we're going to sell a certain number of units because, you know, the nice thing about Top Cow and Image is we at least get looked at. You know, I mean, if you're buried in the back of the previous catalog, you may not even get looked at, ever.
True.
You know, so I know that everything that we do will at least be evaluated as to whether or not a retailer wants to order it. At least people will have probably heard of it. So, you know, and like I said, I look at people's Twitter followings, I look at Facebook, and I don't just look at the number, by the way. I can't tell you how many people I've seen that I know bought their Twitter feed numbers. Because, I look at retweets, I look at, you know, I scroll through people's feeds and look at the interaction they have with other people. Same thing with Facebook pages. I've seen some comic companies with, like Top Cow, I think, I don't even remember how many likes we have on our main Top Cow page. It's not like millions. I mean, it's under 100,000, but we have a tremendous amount of interaction with that fan base on our core Top Cow Facebook page. Same thing with me. I have 5,000 friends. I have another 6,000 or 7,000 people that follow me. That's 12,000 people, but there's a lot of interaction there going on between me and the people on my Facebook page. And, you know, I've seen a couple companies that have 500,000 Facebook followers, and you don't see any interaction at all.
Yeah, I've noticed that, and like I see on your stuff, like you'll post fairly lengthy posts, and then you'll be down like responding to people's comments. It's not just, you know, like you getting something like out there into the ether and then forgetting about it. Like you are in there actually like conversing with people. Like if somebody disagrees with you, you'll have a back and forth with them.
Usually, I would say that's probably I do it enough to where it seems like I do that. You know, some of these posts you'll get hundreds of posts, and I'm like looking at it, I'm like Jesus Christ,
I know you're not in there like commenting on every single comment, but like even going in there and like responding to three people, that's more than, you know, some like big artists, writers, publishers, like stuff like that are ever doing.
Yeah, I think for me it comes down to the fact that I know a lot of these people, and I've met a lot of these people, and I'm trying to maintain that personal touch because I see the weird thing for me is it's really weirder for my wife than anything is because she goes to a lot of these conventions for me, and they're 50 to 100 people there that feel like they know us. You know what I mean? Like we're their friends and we know them personally and we get invited to people's houses and people invite us out for drinks. And I very rarely do that.
I was going to say, do you ever actually take anybody up on going out for drinks?
If I know them, yes. Like other artists and writers and people. But usually, you know, most of these conventions, my schedule is pretty packed. You know, a lot of times in the evenings I'm taking to dinner or going to drinks with either people I'm working with, licensing people, other artists I'm working with on projects, artists I want to work with on a project, and most of these things I've scheduled well in advance. You know,
yeah,
like
you know, you're going to be in the city that they are in, also, so you might as well sit down and like hammer stuff out.
My wife's going with me to Tucson Friday night. We're going out with Jason Gonzalez, and he's a guy that's working with me on a project. And Henry Barajas is going to be there with me, one of my guys, and we're all going to this Mexican place on Friday night. I already know that. So if someone asked me Friday during the day, hey, do you want to grab a drink tonight? I can't do it. You know, yeah. I've already got plans. So, and that's every show, honestly, you know, and a lot of times by the time, particularly a longer show like San Diego or New York, there are parties. And by the time I get to the third or fourth night of some of these fucking shows, I just want to go sleep. You know, I have no desire to go hang out with anyone whatsoever.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of people realize that, like, for you, it's not like, it's not a break from work. Like you're working Monday through Friday, and then you're also working that all day Friday, all day Saturday, all day Sunday at the convention. Whether it's selling your books or going to meetings, like you're working probably longer days than you would on like just a normal like average work day.
almost always, and there are times when deadlines coalesce with conventions, which are the worst, because then a lot of times on the planes and in the hotels, I'm actually writing. And that's happened to me more than a few times, where I'll be stuck in the hotel room trying to get a book done.
You're the boss, though. Can't you just, like, push that stuff off a little bit?
Yeah, but I try not to do that. I mean, that's a slippery slope that cascades. I mean, you push one book off, then it pushes the other book off, and you know, I'm off working 6 months to a year in advance on stuff. So you slip a week, it's never really a huge deal. But you start slipping multiple weeks, then it becomes a problem for the stuff that's further down the line.
Yeah, and plus that, I guess that's not just affecting the company, that's affecting the artist and all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Well, see, that's the golden rule for writers and for publishers, by the way, is you can't leave your artists not working because they'll quit. They'll go find other work because these guys and these girls, they have lives and bills, yeah. And you know, they need the work. And if you don't give them consistent work, they're going to find it.
Yeah, I know. At New York this year, I went to Tom King had like a spotlight panel, and it was him and Dan Didio was like the moderator. And one of the things he said was that when they offered Tom the Batman title, he apparently told him, it's like, you can't be late on this book. If this book is late, that's a store that might close because they bank on Batman coming out every month and getting those sales.
Yeah, it's their golden ticket, you know? I mean, if you look at the Diamond sales charts, they use Batman as the 100% number to affect, so you can figure out what everyone else is selling.
I never noticed that before.
Yeah, the core Batman title, if you look at Diamond's charts, Batman is 100%. So then whatever's above that is 128 or 150 or 250%.
Wow.
And whatever's below that is a fraction of that number.
Wow. Yeah, I never really had to look at the charts, but I never realized that Batman was like the metric they based all that off of.
Oh, and it has been for as long as I've been in the business. So wow. At least 24 years. And that's how Comic-Con is able to figure out the numbers, because I used to do that myself. Because I knew our numbers, so I knew that, oh, Witchblade was 72% of Batman sales, Witchblade sells 26,000, therefore I could figure out what Batman sells, and then I could extrapolate that and figure out what everything sells in a spreadsheet.
Oh, wow.
But the problem with that anymore, like I was talking to you earlier, is none of that tracks Amazon sales, it doesn't track digital sales, and it doesn't track convention sales.
So you have to start pulling from like five different places to try and figure out how many actual copies of a particular book you sold.
I know what we sell because we keep track of it. But I look at those Comic-Con numbers and they show like Sunstone. They show Sunstone selling like 6,000 or 7,000 trades when I know we're selling close to 50,000 trades. You know, when people bring that up, I'm like, look at the category of erotic fiction and graphic novels, and the top five in that category are Sunstone. Sunstone Volume 1 has been in the top five of that category for 4 years.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, that's... So, obviously, that book is selling some serious, serious numbers. I think what I've done is I've kind of given up on tracking what anyone else sells because I kind of don't care anymore. I used to care a lot. But I focus in on what we're selling. You know, like Top Cow's in its 25th year. I've been in part of Image since 24 years. I was at Extreme for the first 5-6 years I was in business, and I've been at Top Cow for 18 years now. And, you know, we continue to do business in a way that works, and we adjust with the times. But it really is, you know, even for a company as mature as Top Cow, it's a hustle game. You know,
yeah.
You can't really rest on your laurels. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, like, as just a comic book fan, like, it's tough to pick what you want to read, too, because there's so much stuff out there. But, like, I know, like Top Cow, like, generally, like, you guys have, and you were saying it before, you sort of have these little, like, pocket universes, I guess is the best way to put it, where, you know, Witchblade doesn't necessarily fall in, like, the same universe as, like, Think Tank, but, you know, Witchblade and Darkness and, like, any of those other Artifact books all fall together, and then you have, like, the books that fall together with, like, Think Tank or, you know, what have you. So, like, it's nice to know that, like, all right, well, I want to read something in sort of this neck of the woods. I can pick up these books and know that there's going to be some sort of, like, cohesion between them. It's not just, you know, well, here's an Image book, and here's one, and they're, you know, three totally different books.
Well, I think part of that, I think you're right with that, and that is strategic. But part of it is if there's a trust level, you know, and like, I'm kind of honest with people. I always ask people, I said, what kind of books do you like? And if they say, oh, I like this, I'm like, well, that's kind of like this. Maybe you'd like this. And because people that like my Aphrodite 9 book, tend to not like my think tank book, and vice versa. And I'm not sure why that is, because I think I write them similarly.
Maybe it's
and
just
so
the settings.
It could be the color, and Af is more of a kind of a superhero kind of figure, and Think Tank's more of a gritty real world setting. Who knows? I mean, I switched Think Tank to color, trying to possibly bridge that gap, and it really didn't work. So, you know, it's tough to say. Like, people that read Think Tank, I can get them to read Postal. People that read Postal, I can get them to read The Tithe. And any of those three, I can get them to cross-collateralize. People that like Aphrodite 9, I can get them to read Cyberforce or Ninth Generation, and I can get them to try Symmetry, you know. And so those are kind of the big ones. Those are the ones I sell the most of at the shows. That Dante book I did sells pretty well, but that was just a one-off. And then, you know, some of the licensing stuff like Warframe and Tales of Honor, that has its unique fans.
Yeah.
I try to cross-sell them, but that's sometimes hard.
Yeah, some of those people that, like, they see Warframe and, like, they like Warframe, they just want to read that.
Yeah,
like, they're not necessarily a comic book fan, they're just a fan of that product.
Yeah, and those are the people that play the game, and yeah, that's their thing, you know? I mean, everyone's got their thing, and if you can try to figure out something that's similar enough and get them to try it, you have a shot at getting them to try something. Like a Warframe player, I think, would like Cyberforce and possibly like Aphrodite 9.
Probably.
So, and I encourage them to maybe give that a shot. And at least there's a chance. And that does happen where people like that stuff. Like, you know, I see older and middle-aged men who come up to chat me up a little bit. And I always pitch them Think Tank because that book definitely skews older. And I kind of explain to them that the science is accurate. My own background, my dad was an engineer for the military. And, you know, we have fun conversations. And I like, you know, I think part of it is I genuinely enjoy talking to people that are interested in potentially or are reading these books. So when people come up and chat me up, I love to talk to them. It's fun for me. I would rather stand there and talk to someone than stand there and stare at people walking by.
Yeah. And, I mean, you seem to never have a shortage of people kind of crowding around your booth, so... That's
well, part of that's tactical. When it gets kind of slow, I'll take a break, you know? I'll leave and come back.
Yeah.
Everything's perception, man. See, this is one of those things I tell people. I said, you know what? You can do one of two things. You can go down and do an Artist Alley booth and be there for 6 or 7 hours, and you can talk to 200, maybe 300 people. Or you can go to the Image booth and get a line of 30 or 40 people, and it looks like you got a really good line, and people will think, oh, hey, this guy's the shit. He's got a decent line. But you're only reaching the 30 or 40 people that are already reading your book.
And even then, you're not really even reaching them, because a lot of those things are just, you know, they get up there, you maybe have a two-minute conversation back and forth while you, like, sign something for them, and then they're moving on, and the next person's coming up.
Yeah, and I tell people, look, at these conventions and when you're talking to people, if you don't feel comfortable doing it, bring someone with you that does. You know, bring your wife, your friend, your boyfriend, whatever it is. Bring someone that can talk. You don't need a booth babe. I mean, that kind of attracts, in a weird way, the wrong kind of attention.
Yeah.
If you can bring someone that will chat you up and talk. And see, that's why I've got people like Henry and Dylan and Ryan. I have a group of people that I know are good chatting. You know, Henry's a little more reserved than Dylan, who's a little more overt. And so depending on the show and what it is, but they're both really good at talking to people. Like, when they're talking to people, you can tell that they're interested, they're having a good conversation. The people on my end know what they're talking about, and they're trying to steer people into stuff that they will like. I think it's also – that's. I think we have a deep enough library of so much content that I could find something that someone likes. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
And you guys definitely do. Like, there, you. And I mean, now you have this sort of, like, slice of life stuff coming out, too. Like, you really could kind of, like, find a comic in the catalog for just about anybody.
Yeah, and if you're a relatively new creator and you only have one book, you don't have that luxury. You know, and I get that. And I think those people hustle is a little harder for them, and they're going to have a much stronger turndown rate. I don't believe in the hard sell. It's not used cars. You know what I mean? I mean, it's a much more casual, I believe in upselling. You know, if someone wants to buy something, I'll definitely try to sell them something else. Cause there's you know, if someone's already got their credit card in their hand, they're more likely to spend than someone who doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's all, you know, it's marketing and business and strategy. I mean, I've taken marketing classes in college and I've taken various things, and, you know, I actually paid for my college education by painting houses. And I got that work walking door to door, knocking on people's door and asking if they'd like a free estimate on their house. And, you know, and I started that in 98 when I first went to UCLA, and I basically and a lot of times I would walk up, and because no one, the great thing about Los Angeles is no one knows each other, right? So people right across the street from each other have no fucking clue who the other person even is. So I would walk up and knock on doors and say, hey, I'm painting, you know, your neighbor's house, you know, six houses down. You know, we're going to be here for the next few weeks. Would you like free estimate? And you can get away with that because you go to, like, you know, Missouri, they'll be like, oh, who? Is that Sonny's house? You know, and he's like, yeah. Oh, shit. So
yeah, I mean, I know exactly what you mean. Like, I spent, you know, in college, I worked retail. Like, I worked at pet stores selling dog training classes, or at Circuit City selling computers. You know, that people don't normally respond to the hard sell. Like, you gotta find that, like, common ground with them, see what they're interested in, and push them in the direction of something that's actually going to, like, catch their eye. Like, handing them a book and being like, you should read this book might not work out if it's a book that they have no interest in.
Yeah, it's the question is what are you trying to do? Are you trying to make a quick buck? Or are you enacting a long term strategy where you build a reader? And this is why I've shifted away from a lot of the variant culture and a lot of the collectability culture, because I'm fine with that. There's these people that collect books, the CGCs and all that stuff, and the variants, and we've certainly been part of that, and we've created even categories of this at Top Cow. But part of the problem with that is it's very fickle. The people that buy that stuff are very fickle about what they want, and if they buy something that they then perceive doesn't have the value they thought it would, you're kind of fucked. So, you know, I think there's trying to force collectability, which is what so many people try to do, and then there's natural collectability. You know, like, I look at a book like Postal Number One. There's only 6,000 of those. You know, if that TV series ever does get on the air, the 6,000 people that own a copy of that book probably will have a tremendous back issue value, you know?
Look at The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't cater as much to the collectible market as we once did, and I personally try to not cater to it much at all. I mean, we'll do, like, a Kickstarter variant, but, you know, I mean, there's still going to be probably 500 or 600 of those. It's not like there's going to be 10, you know?
Yeah. I mean, looking at the Kickstarter, you have 177 backers right now with 20 days to go. So at the very least, you're going to have 200 probably variants, like, just right off the bat that are being sold.
Well, and what we do with the Kickstarters is I don't sell any of the Kickstarter versions into the direct market. I don't sell them at cons. But what I will do, and you'll see in here, is I will sell the Kickstarter versions in other Kickstarters. And so we will sell, and I will sell to people who did buy the Kickstarter, I will sell them additional copies if they come back and ask for those.
Oh,
so,
okay.
We've done that before, you know, where it's like, oh, do you want an extra copy? It'll be an extra $10. It's like the, you know, and I've added retail tiers, and they don't really do that well, but I've added them specifically because I get retailers that kind of complain to me about it. And, like, I'm like, look, if you want, like, if you look at the $50 five copies of Stairways, you can get five copies of that book for $50. You can get 10 copies of the book for $75. You know, we don't have any people ordering that. Those tiers exist because I've had, like, resellers say, you know, why aren't you offering this to us? Well, I am. I'm offering you 10 copies for $7.50 a piece for a $15 book. That's 50% off. You can then resell it if you want to do it.
Yeah.
So, like, Ogotha, I think we printed 500 copies of that version, and we printed several thousand of the direct market version, like 6,000 or 7,000. So the Kickstarter versions are much more limited. But you print them at the same time you print the other books, so it's like it's gang printed.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, and I mean, like you said, it you don't have to necessarily aim for that collector's market anymore. Like that doesn't seem to. It's still definitely a thing. So, I mean, you look at DC and Marvel, and every time they have a new book come out, it's got 40 different variants. But those variants also have like 3,000 copies each, and you times that by the 40 different variants, and it's like there's no shortage of this book out there in one form or another.
Whereas... Yeah, and see, this is to me, if you're a fan of something and you love it and you want to get it signed and you want to stick it in a slab and stick it on your wall or you want to just have it because you're a fan, that's to me is cool. You know, if you're buying 10 copies because you want to sell them on eBay and try to make a little bit of money, I don't really have a problem with that either. But that's a harder road to go, and it's very hard, you know. And there are people that do it very well. I look at Brian Polito as a guy who really works the collectible market really well, but he's doing it with Lady Death, you know, and yeah. He's been doing that with the same character, the same property for 25 years. We're constantly launching new material, which makes it more difficult. You know, you could sell it. See, what we have is expensive licensed stuff. Like, we had that XM Studios Darkness statue, which was $1,500. You know, we also had the Witchblade one and the Magdalena one. And I think we're doing an Aphrodite 9 ones. We have our four biggest characters, and people will drop $1,500. You know, you'll sell 100 of those, you know?
Yeah.
But 100 people drop $1,500 for a giant statue of a character they love. And that's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, and like, I can't necessarily afford a $1,500 statue, but, like, I have a handful of books that are, you know, maybe, like, a particular artist variant or something like that, or just stuff that I've gotten signed because, you know, I really like that particular artist or that particular writer, and I do have them in frames, like, on the wall in the room that I'm sitting in right now. Because, like, I don't have any intention of selling them. I don't have them because they're a collector's item. I have them because that is a particular creator and a book that I enjoyed a lot. So, like, I want to have a copy of that displayed somewhere.
And that, to me, is cool. And that's really what fandom should and is mostly about. I mean, people get a little insane about it at times.
Yes.
But, you know, and I tell people, and I've had to learn this, by the way, is when people get in your face about stuff, I try not to challenge people anymore. It's actually, I got to tell you how difficult that is to do. Because when people, I actually had a guy a couple of months ago who read the ending of Think Tank Volume 5, posted up on my wall, basically, you know, your character wouldn't do this. I don't think this, you know, this is badly, you know, you shouldn't have done this because this guy wouldn't have done this. And I'm like sitting there, and in my mind, I'm like, I'm the only one, I created this character. I'm the only one that's ever written this character. And you're telling me that this character wouldn't do that? You know, my knee jerk to something like that is fuck you. You know, I mean, I think
that takes some balls.
but here's the thing: that guy is a true fan, loves the character, and he's entitled to his opinion. You know, and ultimately, do I give a fuck if he's giving me his money or not? If he wants to tell me how he feels about it. It's actually a very grown-up thing to try to do. It's hard. Believe me, it's very, very fucking hard.
Yeah.
And, but I've sort of learned to kind of roll with that. And I stopped doing it. I used to say, hey, I'm sorry you feel that way. And but I don't even write that anymore. I just, okay. You know, I just, that's a fair point. You know, I'll give that some consideration. And because people just, you know, it's the ones that kind of blow my mind. Like, there was this guy on one of my posts yesterday, people are mean. I mean, the people that are mean for no reason that I've never heard of before are always the ones that kind of blow my mind. Because I posted up this thing yesterday on Twitter about my sons, because my sons are in high school now, and sometimes they're a little teenage entitled, and they get on my nerves. So I posted up this thing, and I said, hey, parents. And I wrote it on Twitter. I said, parents, what do you do about teenage entitlement? Is there anything you do? Because, you know, a lot of times I can engage, and people will give me a good idea. I'm like, oh, fuck, I should do that. And there was a guy on there who did give me a good idea. He basically said, you know, change your Wi-Fi password from time to time and tell them that they need to do X, Y, and Z in order to get it. And I'm like, that's a great fucking idea. Then some other guy, I've never heard of before, didn't know the name, and doesn't even follow me. So it's always weird how they even see this stuff. But posts, it's too late. Maybe you should have been a better parent. And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's like some dude. And I'm like, I would never say that to anyone. You know what I mean? And I just, so for someone to say that, something like that, that's kind of that mean spirited, I just kind of read that and I'm like, man, what's wrong with you? But I don't gauge. I mean, I've sort of developed my social media rules for myself in that I will only engage someone if they post something negatively, if it's factually incorrect, and then I won't engage the negativity of it. I'll engage the incorrect fact and I'll link something to show that what they're saying is incorrect. Or if I personally know this person and maybe they feel like they know me too well, or not, you know, even just know them socially from social media.
Yeah.
Sometimes people feel like they know you a little well and they'll josh with you or they'll say stuff. I'll go in and engage a little bit on that. But I tend to not respond to negativity. I mean, you're never going to change someone's opinion, really. I've kind of figured that out. It's like people are not open-minded, and you know, so there's really no point in engaging people when they're hostile or negative. And so I tend to just ignore it.
One thing I've actually noticed a lot on like social media is you'll have people, so especially like creative people, like whether it's like comics or video games or anything like that. If you have any kind of like a fan base or like a following that's, you know, substantial, you tend to see those people interact more with the people that are negative to them. So, like, I follow a lot of, like, writers and artists on Twitter, and, like, I'll see, like, they'll post something, and then, like, their replies will only be to, like, the person that was the most negative, and they'll go back and forth with them a few times. It's very rarely that they'll, like, say anything to, like, the person that either, like, has something, like a constructive question, or, like, that's, like, complimenting the work. So I think some people get it in their head that it's like, well, if I'm just a huge dick to this person, maybe they'll acknowledge me, and that's cool. I can tell all my friends that, like, I had somebody tell me to go fuck off.
Yeah, I think there's certainly something to that, and I think that happens a lot. I think that skews younger to people that do that, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's that internet troll mentality that's out.
Feeding the trolls is – but again, I'm kind of like – for me now, the trolls are kind of like, you know, if they're out there talking about the thing, I'm not a believer that all press is good press. Like, I don't believe that all press, even bad press, is ultimately good. I don't buy that. But there is something to the fact that people are discussing it and it's out there, you know? So I try to engage people in ways that I think will spur discussion. I try to skew it positive. You know, it doesn't always go that way. I think sometimes when people just, you can kind of tell the mean-spirited people, and I tend to just... I ignore those people. That's the one thing I love about fucking Twitter, you know, is because you can mute people and they don't even know they're muted. And that's amazing. I don't think I have that many people muted, but there's a couple hundred people I've muted on Facebook or on Twitter. And I wish I could do that on Facebook because I still want those people to read what I say. I just don't want to read what they respond, you know.
I follow a couple guys that work for like gaming sites like IGN or GameSpot, stuff like that. And I saw they were, like, going back and forth on Twitter the other day because apparently, like, somebody had actually been, like, they were harassing one of them, and then that person that was harassing them posted something to the other one basically saying, hey, do you ever just ignore people when, like, when they have a, like, constructive thing to say? And the guy wasn't being constructive to begin with. And, like, when you follow, like, the thread down, it turns out, like, both of those people just had him muted and had no idea he was sending anything to them because he's just a dick to them all the time, so why bother?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, if someone's just pathetically trying to get some attention, I mean,
yeah.
You know, what's the point, you know? And it's like, it's the same thing with reviews. I I've talked to a number of comic creators that get obsessed with the reviews they're getting online. And I'm like, you know, no one reads these things. You know what I mean? It's very rare that a comic review on a website is going to influence whether or not someone's going to read something. It's not like movies where there's Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, I know there's that comic book review amalgamator, I forget what it's called, but
there's a couple of them, so,
but no one goes to those.
Yeah,
you know, if you go to the average fan, you know who goes to those? People in the industry, you know. And maybe it might influence your ability to get a job at Marvel and DC, but if you're in my position and that's not what you care about, who cares, you know? I mean, the people that read my books tell me they like them and they buy the next one, so why do I give a fuck what some 19-year-old kid who works at some college is writing in his blog about my book? Who gives a shit?
Yeah, like when my friends and I, when we first launched OneQuest, we were doing a lot, before we did the podcast, we were doing a lot of, like, written pieces. And, like, I reached out to just, like, every comic book publisher I could find, like, not even asking for, like, free copies of books, just literally asking for, like, press release stuff. Like, you know, if you guys are releasing news, like, I'd love to be on the mailing list just so we would have something to put up. And a lot of them, like, put me on the list for review copies, and I was trying to review them as many as I could every week, and it was just, like, getting daunting. That now that we do the podcast, it's like, well, when there's a book that I'm actually enjoying, I'm just going to talk about. Like, I'm not going to spoil it, but anyone that listens is going to hear that, like, oh, I'm actually interested in this. It's not just me trying to have an unbiased opinion on why this book is, you know, a 7.
Yeah. Yeah, and I send, you know, and we send our PDF reviews out to 158 or some people, and I don't even know who half of them even are.
Yeah.
And I used to, when I got back into writing in 2010 and 11, I used to constantly go online and read the online feedback of the books, and I don't think I've done that now in a couple years. I mean, sometimes people will post and link it to me on my page and feed, and then I'll sort of click through it. I know some of my people go and look at the stuff because they're looking for pull quotes for the back of the trades and stuff for like that. But, you know, I mean, it's just a rabbit hole that's not very productive. You know what I mean? I mean, here's what I do with my books. I do the best job I can. And there's enough people that read those that keep me in a nice lifestyle and keep me employed. And I have the greatest job in the world because I get to go make comics every day and ultimately do whatever the fuck I want.
Yeah.
You know, 99.9% of the people out there don't have that luxury.
And
so,
yeah, and your best reviews are going to come from the people that are telling you at a convention, like, oh man, I really loved this book. Like, this book got me back in the comics or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's not going to be the guy at CBR writing 600 words on, you know, why he didn't think issue 5 was as good as issue 4.
Well, there's they're polarizing, too, because it is interesting. Like, the most interesting, and I stopped reading, this is the book that I stopped, after I did Symmetry, I stopped reading comic reviews, and that was the one where I stopped, because the reviews were either insanely positive or they were insanely negative. And there were probably 70-30 positive to negative. So most of them were positive, but there were just a handful of people out there that just, for whatever reason, hated that fucking book. And I was trying to do something very specific with it, and you know, and I'm proud of the work, and people like it, and I'm doing a third volume because we're selling it. That book still sells, you know? The nice thing, like I said, I tell people all the time, is like my books continue to sell every month. Like, I'm selling copies of everything I've ever written. You know, and I don't know how many other people can say that, you know. I mean, a lot of people's work isn't even in print, you know. I mean, Marvel and DC can't keep their entire library in print. It's physically impossible.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things I like about, like, not that Image or Top Kill are small publishers, but I mean, like, compared to Marvel and DC, everything is. Like, I like how quick of a turnaround you guys tend to have on, like, collected volume. I can't necessarily afford to go out and buy every issue every month, but, you know, every 6 months, I can totally drop $15 on a trade.
Right.
And I mean, yeah, it's just, it's easier to keep up with that way. Like I've gotten to the point where, you know, I have the books that I read monthly that I've just been reading since I was, you know, a teenager. But then there's the stuff that, like, every time there's a trade, it's like, cool, trade's out. I'm going to pick that up, whether it's the physical one at a show or, like, I download the digital version. It's like, this is, you know, anywhere from, you know, 80 to 120 pages of something that, like, I can read while I'm sitting on a train or something like that.
Yeah, people like reading the whole stories. I mean, I think the trade thing has been a combination of a lot of it is because so many books for a decade were so late. And it was always the books that people wanted to read by the higher-end creators. And you'd have so many late books. And people stopped, you know, there are so many people that just stopped reading the regular books because if there's a six-month gap between issue 3 and issue 4, are you even going to remember what issue 3 was about? You know, how many comics do you read in 6 months? You know,
yeah, exactly. 300?
So, you know, and then that really was kind of, to me, the tipping point for so many people. And it's just, the other thing is there's a lot of writers, and I get mad at some of these writers because they don't write a very good first issue. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There are certain writers I know that the trades read well, but the individual issues, like, I don't know that I would read past issue 1. You know, it's all set up. There's too much setup and not enough going on. There's not enough characterization that makes me give a fuck about the character. I don't really even know what is going on. I mean, this is my biggest criticism of Marvel of late is I will try to pick up and read some of their new launch books, and it still feels like it's issue 50 of something. It doesn't feel like it is.
Like, even when it's a new number one, like, I get frustrated with the number ones just because it's like, this isn't a number one. This is still a number 700. It's just you put a big number one on it instead.
Yeah.
But one of the what you're saying, one of the sort of best, I guess, anecdotes I ever heard was I went to a thing that Chris Claremont was speaking at a few years ago, and somebody asked him a question about just comics and, like, storylines and stuff like that, and he didn't understand why, like, origins and just stories in general were just so drawn out now, like, for just an arc. And he's like, you know, Galactus, when he debuted in Fantastic Four in the 60s, it was like the first issue Silver Surfer arrived, it was like the second issue was something else, the third issue they beat Galactus in the first half, and then the second half Johnny Storm goes to college, like,
right.
Like, well, one of the, you know, most, well, not one of, like, a few of the most popular characters in comics history, like, that story took place over the course of 2.5 issues.
Right.
And, like, nowadays, not even nowadays, I know when Marvel did their Ultimate Spider-Man back in 2000, I guess that was, 2000, 2001, that origin story for Peter Parker was, like, 15 issues. Whereas, like, Amazing Fantasy was that one issue.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, I think people are trying to draw it out to increase sales, you know? Because I've seen that origins and death books and these various things are what cause increases in sales they're trying to replicate.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, I mean, like you said, it ends up being, like, a not great first issue, where, like, you have to kind of be willing to stick with it for a few to see where the story's going, and at $4 a pop, that's not always something that somebody can really, like, invest in.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, there are fewer and fewer of these books that are being read. You know, I mean, the average sales of books are of the 32-page first-issue comics are much lower than they were even 10 years ago. You know, and because there are so many more new launches today. I mean, they're, like I said, 2,500 books a month. That's just an insane number. I mean, imagine being a retailer and having to comb through a catalog. And that's just comics. That doesn't include toys and T-shirts and other merchandise. 2,500. So, I mean, there's, what, 10,000 things that you can buy on a monthly basis? I mean, can you imagine having to make a choice on 10,000 different items, how many of those you wanted to order into your store for that month?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's insane.
Daunting. I mean, it is very daunting, and I that's why I love comic book stores. I think these guys that are surviving have done an amazing job, and you know, and they should be lauded for it. But they're very conservative, and that's why they've survived. But it makes it hard for fans to find new material.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I mean, I don't know what because you're out in Southern California, right?
Yeah,
yeah. So I mean, I know there are some big stores out there, like not necessarily like size big, just like name wise, like comic book shops that people would like recognize the name of.
Yeah,
like where I'm at, like it's like smaller places, like Fat Jack's Comic Crypt is probably the most well-known one in the Philadelphia area.
I have, and that's been there forever. I did a signing there in 1995.
Do you know which one it was, whether it was the one in Philly or New Jersey?
It was in Philly.
Okay, so my main comic store is actually their New Jersey.
Gotcha.
So I've been going there for like a decade, maybe longer.
Well, you know, Nick Rucci, the Dynamite guy, is based out of Philly, and back in the day, the most money I ever made in a day was from him when I did the Battlestar Galactica comics in 1994 or 5.
Oh, wow.
And it was before the TV show came back. I was the editor at Maximum Press, and I signed 5,000 or 6,000 books for him, and he flew me to Philly to do a signing. At a store, and I signed at Fat Jack's, and then I went over to his warehouse and signed all those books, and he sold all those on QVC. But it was, man, it's crazy.
Yeah,
those are crazy days.
I actually think their office is like a town over from where I live, unless they've moved since then.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I like their books, actually. Of the companies out there, they're one of my favorites.
Yeah, like it's a shame, like, that there are so many publishers out there now that I feel like a lot of them do kind of get overlooked. Like Image seems to have, like, sort of cemented itself in that, like, top tier. But then you have, like your IDWs, your Dynamites, your Booms, even, like, Archie. Like, they're big, but they don't necessarily have the same, like, brand recognition, I guess would be the best word for it, that, like, like the bigger publishers do. And, like, I mean, like, Image is all over the place with, like, books that they publish, but you still, like, you see that little eye in the corner, and you kind of have an idea of, like, where it's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, if you pick up and read an Image book, there's a better quality book on average than a lot of other companies. You know, what you said earlier I think is very true, and I know it's true of a lot of companies. You'll see this really slick cover, and then the interior art is subpar, you know, and that always has been an issue of mine. We call that bait and switch. You know, it's the bait and switch in the industry, and I try not to do that. It's one of the reasons why we don't do as many variants as we used to, and most of the covers you'll notice that are done on Top Cow books are done by the interior artist. In fact, the vast majority. It's very rare that we won't do that.
Which is awesome, because then the cover does actually speak to what the book looks like. So Marvel is probably one of the biggest, like, offenders, like, at least for me, like, I'll look at a book, and I'm like, all right, that cover looks really cool, and then, like, I'll open it up, and I'm like, oh, this artwork this doesn't look good, like, at all. Like, just the anatomy of the person, they don't look like a person.
it's the old bait-and-switch game, you know? The thing is, ultimately, it's one of those marketing things and sales things you learn, is there's no chance anyone will ever buy a comic if they don't at least pick it up.
Yeah, exactly. As somebody who like you have multiple decades in the industry, so like you've kind of seen that trend go, you know, everyone wanted variants, now they don't necessarily want the variants, they want to know what's actually in the book. And
I think people have been burned. I think the average reader is older now, and I think people want to read books that they know they're going to like. It's not just a collectible thing. They want to read something that's an enjoyable experience. I mean, it's the same thing with TV and film. I mean, there's just so much out there. You know, when I was a kid, I saw Star Wars, the first Star Wars, in the theater when I was 7. You know, I mean, that movie was in the theater for a year. People forget that. I mean, the average movie's in the theaters these days, what, 3 weeks? You know?
Yeah, I mean, Star Wars will probably be, like, when The Last Jedi comes out, it'll probably be in for, like, 3 months, give or take.
Yeah, but But these movies were in these theaters for a year, you know? And I remember when I saw Star Wars opening day in 1977, May 25th, 1977. I'll never forget it. And my sister and I and my grandmother, who's been dead now for over 20 years, were the only three people in the theater. That was it. Because people don't understand, it was very different back then. It was a lot of word of mouth, you know? We came back, my sister and I came back 4 days later on a Thursday, I think it was, because it was, well, I don't remember what day it was, but and the theater was packed. So we saw it on opening day, no one in the theater. We saw it 4 days later for the second time, the theater was packed. Word of mouth spread that quickly.
Yeah, now I mean, if a movie has any kind of build up for it, like, you're lucky to find a seat in a theater that's not, like, front row.
Well, and also, if a movie came out and opening day and did pathetic, it would be dumped.
Yeah.
It would never have given that shot, you know, to find its audience. And I think that's the key, is if you believe in what you're doing and the books you're writing and producing, you have to have faith in it and you have to give it a chance to find its audience. You know, you look at shows like MASH and shows like Seinfeld and Cheers, and you go back and look at these, they were allowed to find an audience and became some of the biggest TV shows of all time. You know, when they first debuted, they didn't have a very big audience.
Yeah, and nowadays, if a show doesn't have, you know, Big Bang Theory numbers in its first three episodes, it's canceled in its first season.
Yeah, and you never get to see where it goes. And it's kind of sad, because I think we're missing out on a lot of possible good, you know, content that evolves. And it also has changed the way this stuff is done, because now it's so much about shock value and spectacle to try to grab that audience immediately and get them to read and maintain it. And part of this could be my age, and I acknowledge that, but I can't even watch, like, the last Transformers movie. You know what I mean? I mean, it just looks so bad to me that I've never seen it. You know what I mean?
To be fair, I mean, you said you're almost 50, so there's about almost a 20-year gap between us. I completely agree with that. Like, I have yet to see the last one. I thought the one before that was just awful. Like, I saw it, like, 6 months after it came out, and I'm just like, I just wasted 2 hours of my life.
Yeah, Silvestri, who's 10 years older than me, he made the funniest statement I've ever heard, because after that last one that came out that no one liked, I didn't like it either, the first Mark Wahlberg one, I'm like, what the fuck is this? This extra planetary group, they're going to catch this guy with a fucking net? And after I saw that, I'm like, what the fuck is this? And Mark said, you know what, these movies have become basically crinkled up. People are crinkling up tinfoil in front of the screen for 2 hours. And when he said that, I laughed my ass off. And
that's what it is. It's that and superhero movies. Like, as much as I like comic books, like, we're just getting oversaturated with comic book movies. And it's like, Marvel's doing great, like, money-wise with, like, their formula. But, like, it's kind of all the same.
Yeah, the last, I'm trying to think what the last two or three Marvel movies are. I liked Ant-Man. I didn't like Ultron.
So, I mean, you're actually going back quite a few years at this point. I think the last three were Spider-Man.
Homecoming?
Spider-Man Homecoming was this past July. Guardians Volume 2 was in April or May. And then I want to say it was Doctor Strange was last November.
Okay, I've actually seen all of those. And I think all those are better than that Ultron movie and Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
I mean, Ant-Man I liked a lot because I thought it was fun. But the Guardians of the Galaxy movies are really what I've sort of evolved a new discussion, what I'm calling a post-plot period in Hollywood. And I've kind of explained to people, because I always ask people this question, especially non-comic book nerds that like Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm like, tell me what that first movie was even about. What was the movie about? And they won't tell you the plot of the movie. What they'll tell you is that, oh, Chris Pratt did this, or, you know, there was this thing that was this. And it's all really about, you know, these scenes and these character bits and all this sort of stuff. It's not really about the plot of the movie. And it's surprising to me how people can't even explain what the plot of Guardians of the Galaxy even is.
Yeah, because I guess, like, really it's one of those things, like, if your stars are charming enough, people are going to just enjoy watching them.
Yeah, it's weird, but that's just how it is.
Cause, I mean, even if you look at, like, the first Iron Man, I think that was a legitimately good movie. The sequels, not as much, but, like, Robert Downey Jr., he's still charming as hell as Tony Stark. So, like, every time he's Tony Stark, I'm gonna watch it.
me too. And I've seen all the Iron Mans, and I just you know, the biggest problem I have with Iron Man 3 is they have the house party thing at the end of the movie. I'm like, why didn't they do that at the beginning of the movie and then the movie be over?
Yeah.
You know, and I just, there's all these sort of weird plot holes that you can drive a truck through, but it seems like people don't care, and I'm surprised how many people don't give a fuck about the plots of these movies. As long as the characters are charming, it's interesting to look at. People just don't seem to give a fuck. You know, the movies that everyone lauds as having great, complicated storylines and emotional landings, those movies never perform very well at the box office.
Yeah, they're usually, like, they do great at award shows, but, like, their actual box office intake is usually, like, fairly low. But, you know, Fast and the Furious 7 or 8 comes out, and it breaks $1 billion.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, like, to be fair, like, I've seen all the Fast and the Furious movies. They're not good movies, but they're fun movies to watch.
Yeah, see, I agree with you there. Those movies are fun, and they don't need to be complicated plots. And I the one I haven't watched is the last one because it just looks so stupid to me.
If you have 2 hours, watch it just for some of just it. They could not top 7, where like they're driving cars out of planes and jumping between buildings, but right. it still has some of the just like. Who thought this was, like, physically possible that somebody could pull this off moments that you just can't help but, like, watch and laugh at?
All right, you sold me. Yeah, I'll watch it.
I mean, at one point in the movie, like, this isn't really a spoiler. Like, The Rock leans over and picks up a missile or a torpedo and turns it around to shoot it off at somebody else, like, before it hits him.
Okay, yeah, I don't know how that'd be physically possible, but okay, you know? That's the kind of stuff that kind of makes me laugh because, you know, like I said, my background, I have a master's degree in physics.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. So you're gonna look at that. And it's just one of those, like, yep, sure, like Hollywood. And I guess, I mean, because you've at least worked somewhat in Hollywood, right? Like with like the Top Cow stuff that has like been like optioned for TV and movies and everything.
Yeah. No, I mean, we've certainly been, I mean, most of what we work with are writers. You know what I mean? I mean, that's more than anything, all work with the writers and the development of stuff. We're not necessarily working as much with the producers, and we're not really on set, kind of thing.
So, but I didn't know if like you'd just, you know, just from osmosis kind of like seen how just crazy something simple can like grow into when it comes to like a television.
Well, I was on the set in Chicago for Wanted when they were filming the scene with Angelina Jolie driving the red car.
Okay.
Where she did the spin move and it picked up James McAvoy. I was there when they shot that. It was interesting to watch. I gotta say, the one thing that kind of blew my mind about physical production and on sets is how god awful boring it is, and how people really don't understand. Because I was there for 8 hours while they were doing that, and I think I saw Angelina Jolie and James McAvoy for maybe 15 minutes.
That makes sense.
They would set up and do these shots and spend all this time and do all this stuff, but it would be these tremendously long processes and that for a little payoff. But I don't know.
Yeah. But, you know, I just realized it's actually getting fairly late, and I don't want to keep you too long. We've been going for almost 2 hours. So I know you said you weren't as concerned with trying to get Stairway over the goal since you destroyed it already. But I'm definitely going to throw the link and everything to that in the show notes. Okay. Do you have do you want to, like, pitch all your social stuff and Top Cow's social stuff where people can find
sure.
you?
I mean, the Top Cow is just, if you go on any social media platform, it's just Top Cow because it's such a unique name. It was easy for us to get. We're on Kickstarter. We're on Instagram. We're on Tumblr. It's Facebook. Just put Top Cow in there and our page will pop up. Same with @TopCow. On Twitter, I'm just Top Cow Matt, M-A-T-T. And if you go into Facebook and you Google, or not Google, if you put Matt Hawkins in there, the two pop up normally are me and the South African rugby player. And it's very clear. I'm usually the one with comic book shit behind me, and he's a big, rugged-looking blonde guy. So it's I'm not him.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was actually trying to pull up your Twitter earlier, and rather just going to Twitter and searching it there, I just typed your name into Chrome, and like it defaults to the rugby player. I'm just like, crap. So I went back. I'm just like, comics, and you pop right up.
Yeah. So it's just, yeah, if you type Matt Hawkins or Matt Hawkins Top Cow or Matt Hawkins comics, yeah, you're going to find all my feeds very easily, but, you know, worldwide rugby, maybe he's a little more popular than me. Makes me sad. But no, Stairway, for people that have read any science fiction books I've done or are a fan of science fiction, I mean, the basic idea of Stairway is that, you know, in 2012, some scientists at Harvard actually discovered that we're able to record data on DNA like a computer hard drive. And so that started spurring my imagination as to, well, what does that mean about junk DNA? If we've always called this stuff junk DNA, it's the DNA we can't understand. They called it non-coding DNA about 4 years ago, so it's no longer called junk DNA. But so if my thought, if information can be recorded that's extraneous and not related to your body or functioning or any sort of thing, it can just be random information, then why couldn't someone 10 million years ago have recorded a bunch of information on our DNA to pass it along? And, you know, if it was our creator or if it was someone that wanted to pass something along, think about it. If you wanted information to sustain millennia, you wouldn't record it in a book. You wouldn't write it on a document. You wouldn't build a temple because none of those things are guaranteed to be there. However, generational DNA that is guaranteed to at least somewhat maintain over thousands of generations, there'll be some degradation, but you'd be able to uncover it. I would use that method to maintain information if I wanted people 10 million years from now to read something. And so these scientists, when they start looking into this DNA, they realize that there's schematics, bioschematics, and information that's been left there, and they start decoding it. And that's sort of the genesis of the story, is what happens if you try to build this stuff? You know, is it safe? What would happen to the world? And how would it affect the people that do it? And the idea of a stairway is it's actually a stairway to heaven, because they're building a bridge basically to talk to the gods that created us. And how does that affect religion and science and all these sort of things? And all these things I'm fascinated with. I actually think the Stairway is my finest work to date.
Yeah, like as soon as I saw the sort of just like the tagline for it, I'm just like, this sounds super interesting. And because I've seen your stuff on Facebook where, like, I know you have this, like, fascination with religion and science and everything, it's like, I figured that the book was going to delve into things very, like, intelligently. It wasn't just going to be, you know, oh, yeah, the DNA has some stuff in it and it's going to lead to to aliens or something. Like,
right.
I mean, it might lead to aliens, but it's not just going to be that, like, straight leap to, like, oh, yeah, we found this. Oh, it's aliens. Like, it'll have some sort of interesting and thoughtful path that leads it to wherever it goes.
Well, and what I'm trying to do is tell a fun story, but base it in real science to where this is something that could be possible. And ultimately, the story here is about a woman, a single mother, who is trying to protect her child. And that's at the core of what the story is really about. So that's the emotional center of it. And I'm really happy with how this book came out. I don't say that about everything I've done, but I think anyone, this is what I call my bridge book, and it's part of the reason why I created it. I think if you like Think Tank or you like Aphrodite 9 Symmetry, fans of either one of those titles, I think both those groups will like this book.
And you said the book's actually already done, so the digital reward will actually go out relatively soon once the Kickstarter's over?
Yeah, I mean, we should send it out almost immediately. I mean, I continue to play around with it. I mean, I think the Kickstarter runs for another 20 days or so, but the last few pages lettered, and I need to finalize some of the science class stuff. But I've already done 98% of the work on this book, so we just need to compile it. And then once we close this thing out, we'll lock the print run and go ahead and print it, because I think it's available through the regular direct channels in April. Like Golgotha, which earlier this year, I think just came out last week into the regular channels.
Okay. Yeah, it looks like right now you have estimated delivery as March for the physical copies, so I guess that would be the month before it actually goes to direct market.
I think that's too quick. I think I'm wrong. Hold on. Okay, here it is. Yeah, actually, I'm sorry. It's going into direct market in June. So, yeah, people will receive their regular physical copies in March. It'll go into the direct market in June, because usually there's a 3 or 4 month window of exclusivity that we try to maintain, so that it gives some sort of semblance of an advance thing for the people that do the Kickstarter.
Which is cool, and we talked about before that you have a lot of, the rewards aren't just all, well, here's the book and here's, you know, a different cover of the book. It's, you know, you have that stuff, you have other books that you can get with it. I have it backed at the $40 pledge level, the like behind the scenes and all that stuff.
Cool.
Just because I think that stuff's really cool, and a book like this, like I want the physical copy, but I also want a digital one because that's how I'll probably end up reading it.
Right.
But yeah, and I mean, I'd say you have those basically like get help getting published tiers, but those sold out like immediately.
Yeah, I did. I was surprised actually how quickly that sold out. And so then I added the second tier, which sold out immediately too. And I almost added the third tier, but I'm like, I don't have time for that.
Yeah, because at that point, even 10 of us, like, man, he's going to help 10 people get like a short story published. You know, that's not a small amount of work.
Well, the thing is it's like we were talking about earlier in this conversation, is it's very hard to get people to read a script. But if I can help 10 people put out a decent short story, and it's been published by Image Comics and Top Cow, there's a decent chance that you can send that to DC and Marvel editors at various companies, and they'll actually give it a read. And if they like it, they're more inclined to pay attention to you. So it is a stepping stone, and that's kind of what Top Cow Talent Hunt has done. I'm very proud of the fact that there are many of the Top Cow Talent Hunt winners that have gone on to sort of semi-illustrious careers. You know, I mean, yeah. Teeny Howard is probably the forefront. She's writing for multiple companies. You know, Isaac Goodhart is part of the DC Talent Hunt and also the artist on Postal. And there's several, you know, and I'm proud of that. It makes me feel good to look out and know that I've helped people kick off their career.
Yeah, and I mean, you kind of said it earlier. Like, it's not easy for an artist to get into the industry, but it's easier because, you know, you can all, at a con, you can always look at somebody's artwork. And if it even looks almost decent, you can, like, talk to them for a few minutes about it. And, you know, like, the big publishers are always having those, like, drop off your portfolio sort of things on, like, a Friday, and if they like you, they'll call you back on Sunday. But, like, anyone that wants to write, you have a rougher path in, because there's really, like the Top Cow Talent Hunt is one of the few things I ever see that's, like, here, if you want to write comics, here's your chance to get something published.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, there was some criticism of the DC Talent Hunt, and I think it's not really fair, because DC was very specific that they are actually looking for people who have had existing publishing experience. So if you look at the people who won the top, the DC Talent Hunts, almost all of those people were already working in comics. They just weren't working for DC.
Yeah, whereas yours is very specifically, like, you cannot have been published before.
Correct. So ours is really sort of a shot for new people. And look, there, we've done it for, this is our fifth times, and we've done probably 20 winners in the category. So half of those people were unable to move on and get work elsewhere. But, you know, the other half have. And we gave people a shot. We gave them a platform and a spotlight on them. And every year we've done it, we've evolved how we do it to try to make it a little better. I mean, the thing with this year is we actually have fewer winners, and I did that on purpose because it's just it's so hard and such a time-consuming process that, you know, I've whittled it down. I mean, for us, it's like we're just now putting out the winners from last time. It takes that long to do it. I mean, and we've put out everything, so there's not been anyone that's won that hasn't had their thing come out eventually. But it's not like it comes out 6 months later. Sometimes it comes out a year or 18 months later.
Yeah, I mean, even for those people that haven't actually like made like careers out of it, like they got something published. Like if having a published comic is something that like they dreamed of doing, like you helped somebody's dream come true.
Yeah. And that's, it's cool, you know, and like I said, I remember the very first book that had my name in it was Brigade Number 2. It was an Image comic, came out in early 1993. I was listed as an assistant editor, and I think I grabbed 20 copies of that book, and I sent it to all my family, because I was so proud of the fact that I was listed in this book. And so I know that feeling from personal experience, you know, and which is funny, because my wife co-wrote Swing with me, and we had a preview book at New York Comic Con, and it was the first time not only was her name listed, but I actually listed her name on the cover too, and she didn't give a fuck. She just did not.
No, I was so offended. I was gonna say, do you still have like your first book?
Probably not. I mean, I had a pretty substantial long box collection of comics that got destroyed at a public storage facility during a flood.
Oh, that's awful.
It was in the basement here in Los Angeles, and the flood was from a broken water pipe. And it wasn't just I lost my comics, I actually lost all my childhood trophies and all kinds of photos. So it was actually a pretty devastating loss. This was about 10 years ago. It is what it is. So
yeah, that's still a shame. Like I've had stuff like that, not necessarily like a flood, but like I've had bad shit like that happen where like I have just lost things that they're irreplaceable, and you just kind of have to like deal with it at a certain point.
Well, I just popped into eBay and I put Brigade 2 available. I could buy a Brigade 2 for $5. So, I mean, if I really wanted it, I could pick it up.
that's not bad. And I mean,
you know,
yeah. Yeah, and I mean, like, you have your name on so many books at this point that, like, you could actually walk into a comic book shop and find your name on something.
Yeah, I do that. You know, I was at Extreme for 6 years. I went to Awesome Comics for a year, and then I've been at Top Cow for 18 years, whatever it is. I think 6 years is too long at Extreme. I think it was 4, whatever the math adds up to. It just seems, when you're younger, stuff seems like it's longer than it is.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
And, but no, I think I did the math at one point. I think my name's been in like 2,000 or 3,000 books.
Wow. And that's in various like positions, like editing, writing, all that.
Yeah, and it's crazy because the very first book I ever wrote was Lady Pendragon number one. It sold 700,000 copies because the market was different then. You know, I mean, it was a completely different market.
Because that was like the late 90s, right? So that was kind of like where like it was starting to like come back after like Marvel and DC sort of like crashed everything.
No, the first issue of Lady Pendragon came out in 1995. I then launched the regular series in 1998. Oh, okay. So the 95 book I did that was a one-shot that came out from Maximum Press sold 700,000 copies.
Wow.
And I still to this day, I'm kind of mesmerized by that. I mean, if I sell 10,000 of a 32-page book, another 10, 15, 20,000 trades, and then another 5 or 6,000 in digital copies, I'm jumping for joy because I'm making good money. Do you know what I mean? But you compare that as an aggregate is what, like 30,000 to 50,000 compared to 700,000. It's not even in the same metric.
Yeah, that's kind of insane. Like I remember. I mean, not that I'm old enough to actually remember, but what was it? X-Men number one, the Jim Lee run from like what 91, 92.
Yeah,
I know that one had some like 200,000 copies, something like that, sold like in the first day.
Oh my God, dude, that book sold like 1.6 million copies.
I thought that was like over like the span of like the month or something.
That could be. I don't know. I just know because I remember I was around. I knew those guys. All the Image founders I know pretty well. And they would compare, like Rob would compare his X-Force sales. Jim would compare his X-Men sales. And it would be the schlong swinging contest 24/7, but it was fun. I wouldn't trade those dates for anything. It was a lot of fun being part of the original Image crew.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I've not really ever gotten to meet many of them, but like the few times like I've seen like any of them at a convention, they always seem like just like the nicest guys. And for like kind of like the level that they are at in comics, like they don't necessarily have to be.
Yeah.
And like for all like the shit that you always like hear like Rob gets from like people, I met him at New York one year, and he was just the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, when you get older, you mellow out, you have kids, you sort of, I mean, everybody, no one likes being given shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Rob, I think, has been given an inordinate amount of shit, but he has developed a very thick skin and an interesting way of handling it. But if I got attacked like he gets attacked, I don't know that I would be in this business anymore. So I give him a lot of kudos for having the brass balls. And he's a rich guy. I mean, he's made millions and millions of dollars in this business, and has made a lot of money off of Deadpool royalties from the film. And he had the Bob Kane deal, so he's making tons of money. I think he probably, in the last couple of years, has made more money in comics than anyone. I mean, it's him and Kirkman and a couple guys that are rivaling the volume, just the sheer volume of money that they're personally making.
Wow. Yeah, I never thought about that. I guess when you're making that kind of money, like it's easier to be nice to like somebody who just wants to come up and say hi to you.
Well, you can go either way with that. It can be either really nice, or you can tell people to go fuck themselves, you know? And
yeah.
I Rob, I think, has aged well. And I think Rob, at his core, is a nice guy. I like Rob. He gave me my shot in comics. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. And I genuinely like the guy. So it's hard for me to see people give him some shit. But I see him doing some stuff online where he attacks people, too. And I'm always, you know, I'm always like, why are you doing that? And I think he sometimes gets bored and does it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I always ask him, and then I'm like, why do I really want to get into that? And I don't.
That's fair. But yeah, you know what? Let's call it there. Just I because it's almost what, 5 o'clock for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure you want to. I don't know if you're home or in the office right now, but I'm sure you want to go see your family.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have a dinner thing with Silvestri and some people tonight. I got to be somewhere at 7:30, so I have a little bit of time. But I got to get ready and shower and all that. But
yeah.
No, man, it's been really good talking to you. I'm certainly happy to come on again if you want to do a follow-up.
Yeah, that would definitely be great.
if there's any one of my people that you want to talk to, anyone you see working with Top Cow or affiliated, I could certainly help make that happen.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much. Yeah, I've been making a list actually of people, because what I want to do is, like, I said this vaguely in the email. We do it's a weekly show generally where, you know, we talk about just nerdy stuff like video games, comic books, television, movies, like kind of whatever we've been doing that previous week and any news that's happening. But I've been like trying to like basically spin off like a separate show of, you know, like stuff like this, like just conversations with people that, you know, work on comics or games or in media or what have you. So
cool.
So I appreciate that offer.
Yeah, if there's anyone that I know that you want me to intro you to, I'm happy to.
Thank you. And yeah, I mean, like I said, I will have all of all the Kickstarter stuff in the show notes just so people can find it, because the book looks gorgeous and the pitch for it just sounds super interesting.
Cool. Well, I hope you like it, man. Let me know what you think.
Great. Thanks. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next time. Bye.
Thanks, Chris. Take care, everybody.